for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1 on LBC, it's Jim Diamond, but next, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We'll be talking about debating, as that skill is about to be prioritised in the school curriculum. We'll look at why so many people are being released in error from our jails. And we'll hear about Prince William, what he says is a failure of business to address climate change. And we'll talk about why so many people seem to have dropped out. We'll get the latest from America with our US correspondent. But first, the DG and the news CEO of the BBC are OUT. Is this a crisis the Beeb can survive? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. President Trump has accused the former Director General of the BBC and his outgoing Chief Executive of News of being dishonest people. He's been writing online following the resignations of Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus. It's thought the corporation will apologise tomorrow over the editing of a Donald Trump speech. LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark, has been talking to staff at the BBC.
One has said, you know, potentially this has just been something that he's been hinting at for a while. One has told me, and obviously this looks a little bit like the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of what the BBC have been able to sort of deal with.
Writing online, the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy's been thanking Tim Davey for his work in public service broadcasting. The former chief executive of BBC News said the buck stops with her as she announced her resignation. Both Deborah Turnus and Mr. Davey have been facing increased pressure over the episode of Panorama about President Trump and further allegations of bias. The media lawyer Jonathan Code has been telling LBC worries about balance at the corporation are not fanciful.
Here we've got the Director General and the Head of News both going. It looks as though the BBC thinks this is seismic. And I think the other thing about it is it isn't just to do with Donald Trump. What this is, in my view, is evidence of a bias in the BBC which goes together, just the Donald Trump one and the very biased coverage, in my view, of the Gaza war.
And there'll be more on this story throughout the evening with Nick Abbott here on LBC. A super typhoon has brought wind speeds of more than 140 miles per hour to the Philippines. At least two deaths have already been reported because of the storm, which has been named Feng Wong. More than 1 million people have been evacuated. Two trains have collided in Slovakia, injuring a number of people. Police say it happened about 12 miles outside the capital, Bratislava. The UK is sending military experts and equipment to Belgium after a spate of drone sightings near airports. They led to flights being grounded in Brussels during the last week. And in sport, Steve Tandy's first game as the Welsh Rugby Union head coach has ended in a record defeat against Argentina. They were beaten 52-28 in Cardiff, with the Pumas scoring 7 tries. LBC weather, rain, which could be heavy at times, will move north from the southwest overnight. Clear skies will then develop behind it. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
So Tim Davey has announced his resignation as Director General of the BBC over allegations of bias at the corporation. This is after it was accused of airing a doctored clip of a speech by Donald Trump and questions on its coverage over Gaza and trans issues. Tim Davey is walking away with Deborah Turnus, the Chief Executive of BBC News. Both have resigned, not were sacked. Let's talk about this first with Professor Richard Tait. Professor Tait is a former member of the BBC Trust who chaired the Editorial Standards Committee. He's also a former editor of BBC Newsnight, Channel 4 News, and editor-in-chief of ITN, and now Professor of Journalism at Cardiff University, and he joins us on the line. Good evening, Professor.
Evening, Nick.
Did Tim Davey have to go?
I think he thought he had to go. I think what's happened is two very senior executives have gone because of mistakes made by other people. but broadcasting is a pretty pitiless business, and the buck stops for the people at the top.
It's quite a long time ago, though. Was it the actual act of mis-editing, as it's been described, or was it the attempted, not necessarily cover-up, but the ignoring of that being brought to their attention?
That's a very good question. I think that in the end, it was something different. I think it was an accumulation of editorial mistakes over the last year or so, which meant that the BBC could just about weather one, but they had a number of problems over Gaza, and then they had the problem of the panorama. And I think the revelation in the Telegraph that the senior management had known about it some months ago was probably the last straw.
Well, then, if it was just over the last few years, would that not coincide with the tenure of Deborah Turnis, who had come to be the news chief at the BBC from ITV?
Well, I mean, Deborah Turnis has had a fantastic career. She's a unique career in British broadcast news. She was the head of NBC. She was chief executive of ITN. And now she is, until tonight, chief executive of the BBC. She's a very experienced executive. I mean, the BBC has now lost its two top managers tonight. I think you've got to look at the way in which the BBC is currently organised and the way in which it currently handles the sort of tsunami of pressures and lobbying, which is part of modern broadcasting.
So is the BBC then judged by different metrics than commercial operators?
I think it is a bit, because I think, you know, you had a clip in your news of a very familiar complaint from one side of the argument on the Middle East, which is you're biased against Israel. You'll find people on the other side of the argument who will tell you that they're biased in favor of Israel. I think that it's one of those areas where, you know, you can't necessarily win. And I think that what's happened in the BBC currently is that they're trying to accommodate a world where impartiality is not accepted by quite significant minorities of the audience. The core audience does. And I think as far as commercial broadcasting is concerned, I think you're right. I think people who work in commercial broadcasting find they get a slightly easier ride, partly because I think they're very good at defending themselves. I don't think the BBC has been robust enough in defending its own journalism. But also because, let's be frank, the BBC has the biggest market share, and therefore if you're trying to influence coverage, the BBC is the best place to go if you want to try and skew the coverage in the direction that you want it to go.
Is it getting to become an almost impossible task to tread a line of supposed impartiality in a world that is now just a soup of fake news and partiality?
Well, I think you're right to describe the world we're working in, Nick. But I do think that all the surveys that are done of audiences show that most of the audience do value impartiality and accuracy, and they do recognise that broadcasters like the BBC, but also like LBC and ITN and Sky, work really hard to try and be fair, to try and be impartial, and try not to be captured by one lobby or another. And I think that you're never going to satisfy the people on the edges of the argument in these very, very difficult areas like Gaza or trans or what you think about Donald Trump. There's groups of people who will never accept that anything you do is impartial unless it tells you exactly what they want you to hear. But I think for the majority of the audience, most of the opinion polls I've seen over the last 15 years have been pretty consistent. People think that the broadcasters should be impartial. They may not do it brilliantly all the time, but it's worth the effort.
Yes, but is that not an impossible thing to achieve? Total impartiality. I mean, we're not robots, we're human beings.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And therefore, you shouldn't be judged by some impossible standard of purity. I think what it's about is about your intention. And I think impartiality is actually based on respect for the audience, which is, if you respect your audience, you want to tell them what's happening rather than tell them what to think about it. And I think that there's still value. I mean, if you look at the BBC, British commercial broadcasters, you look at agencies around the world like Reuters and Associated Press, these are respected because they try and tell people what's going on and they try not to be captured by the factions and the political parties and the lobbyists who have really taken over social media. And therefore, we now increasingly look like we're sort of out of step with what else is going on in broadcasting in terms of the way in which social media has become very partisan. But actually, the audience still likes something which tries to be impartial, even if it doesn't succeed all the time.
Yes, and in trying to be impartial, is it possible to paint a picture of a person that is true in its essence, but might not be true in its particular detail? And this is the nub of it, isn't it? How they depicted Donald Trump.
Well, I think the depiction of Donald Trump is a very interesting issue, isn't it? Clearly, the edit was wrong. It shouldn't have been done. The BBC made a terrible mistake in trying to defend it. But I don't think there's much doubt that there was a relationship between what Donald Trump said that day and what the crowd who was listening to him then did.
Yes, precisely right. He said, you should fight like hell, and then they promptly did.
Well, the reason why the BBC got in trouble was that they were two bits of a speech an hour apart, and in the first bit he was talking about marching down to the Capitol, and the second bit he was talking about fighting what he claimed falsely had been a stolen election.
Mm.
But everybody, I mean, if you remember the coverage on the day, I mean, some of that Robert Moore's great coverage for ITV News that night, was absolutely clear that the president's rhetoric had been a factor in what had happened.
Is that not the picture that the BBC was trying to present?
Was,
I mean, you said it was false editing. It, because what somebody from Inside TV said that it was a Franken edit, which is probably an industry yeah. term, and they said that they could have had a wipe or a splice or some sort of screen image that showed you that the one sentence did not follow the other. Would that have sufficed to cover their backs?
I think the trouble is that those of us who followed this story, particularly the whole question about whether Trump incited the riot or not, it's such a sensitive area that I would have thought that the people making the program would have known that this is a very, very delicate area where you have to be very precise and if you like, very straight in what you're doing. And I think that the edit they did was just not justifiable. And it was silly because they could have edited it in a way that made complete sense to the audience and wouldn't have caused the enormous grief that it has done. It was a mistake, and there's no point going away from it.
But do you think it's a bit rich that Donald Trump, a man who verifiably made 30,573 false or misleading claims during his first term at a rate of 15 a day, is accusing others of making false or misleading claims?
Well, I think what's equally astonishing is I don't know if you looked at the White House website tonight, but they're sort of almost claiming the departure of Tim Davies a victory for Donald Trump.
Yes,
and that's a sign of the sort of the slightly mad world we're currently now in, where with social media and with the BBC in particular in the sights of quite a large section of the political argument in Britain. Because, you know, from being a sort of privatised BBC or shut it down, from being quite a fringe fringe policy, you now find that both the Conservatives and Reform are saying, well, maybe we should get rid of it. And the consensus that we should have a BBC publicly funded that does impartial journalism has frayed and is actually one of the big problems for the people coming in to replace Tim and Deborah is going to be they're going to have to try and re-establish a consensus in Britain that we actually do need a BBC. I think the crisis is that serious.
Yeah, I mean, just on this this edit and the Trump's relationship with the press and his people's relationship with their acolytes in this country, because Trump is attacking the media in America. He says anything that reports about him that it is fake news unless it's flattery. And the news media has crumbled in America, and its ability to tell the truth has been corroded because parent companies need Trump's approval to complete merger deals. And so they're paying out tens of millions of dollars, and they're changing their top brass in order to make the news more flattering to Donald Trump. Has he, in fact, Trump, joined forces with those in this country who have always wanted to get rid of the BBC because it's a competitor?
Well, that's a bit how it looks tonight, isn't it, Nick? But I think it is one of those cruel realities that if you want to take on Donald Trump, or if you want to cover a really difficult area like trans rights, or you're an area like the conflict in Gaza, and you're saying we are an impartial and accurate news organization, you've got to be an accurate and impartial news organization. And any mistake you make is going to be exploited, maybe even excessively, by your enemies. And what the BBC has done by making a series of mistakes has made it more vulnerable to those people who want to shut it down. And that's one of the reasons why the new management has a really big job to try and reestablish consensus. But it's, you know, we shouldn't shut down the BBC just because somebody made a rather careless edit of a Donald Trump speech.
No, and I mean, this sort of goes back to how the BBC are treated completely differently to other media organisations, because there's TV stations that call themselves news that would complain loudly if they were accused of being biased, but they clearly are. It's 24 hours a day diet of propaganda from the right. And the wild west of the online spaces that people get their information from these days. I mean, is it possible that this is actually just TV business people, those on the inside, who are getting a bit precious about all this?
Well, no, I think the thing is, there is a difference between, I know exactly the sort of channel station you're talking about. I think there's a difference in what they do and what you're doing on LBC and what I did when I was editor-in-chief of ITN and what Deborah Turness was doing until tonight on the BBC, which is because public service broadcasting news is trusted in Britain. People trust LBC, they trust Sky, they trust ITN, because we do set ourselves very high standards, and that may make us look somewhat sort of pretending that we're sort of better than everybody else. It's not that. It's actually saying if you don't set really high standards, and when you do make a mistake, you put your hands up, even if elsewhere it's a wild west, you're going to lose the credibility, which is your absolute gold benefit of having public service broadcasting.
How do you think Tim Davis' tenure will be judged?
I think he did an amazingly good job dealing with probably the most hostile government in the history of British broadcasting, which was the Boris Johnson government, and then a little bit of Liz Truss, who also hated the BBC. They cut the budget in real terms. They complained endlessly, and they began to threaten the BBC if it didn't change its coverage with all sorts of sanctions. I think he managed that situation very well. He managed the fact that he had much less money every year in real terms. He's a good manager. He's a very decent man. He really cared about public service broadcasting. And I think that the politicians created circumstances which anyone would have struggled. And I think he managed that situation pretty well. So, but you don't get much thanks in the broadcast business for doing that.
Good to talk to you, Professor. Thanks so much for that. That's Professor Richard Tait, former member of the BBC Trust. He chaired the Editorial Standards Committee, also a former editor of BBC Newsnight, Channel 4 News, editor-in-chief of ITN, and now professor of journalism at Cardiff University. So what do you make of this, then? It's the case that Tim Davey has announced his resignation. He was the director-general of the BBC. Deborah Turness, who's only been in the job a couple of years, has also walked away. She was chief executive of BBC News. Should that be it? Should a line be drawn under it? Or is there further punishment deserved, do you think? 0345 6060 973, LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why is there delay?
Straight to the point.
This government is unravelling everywhere you look.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How can that make sense to anyone?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Yes, we are talking about the crisis at the BBC. It is a crisis of trust, I suppose. How do you think the BBC can restore that trust? 0345 6060973. Penzance. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm sure you know this, and I'm sure many of the listeners will, but this is just part of a continual orchestrated attack on the BBC by the right-wing media and political class to try and force them to promote right-wing views to equalise them with the truth. And the idea that the BBC, what you hear all the time is the BBC has a left-wing bias and it's anti-Israel. But until recently, the DG was Richard Sharp, who was a Jewish banker from Goldman Sachs appointed by Boris Johnson for services to arranging dodgy loans. And not long before him was Chris Patton, who was a Tory grandee. We had Robbie Gibb, who was head of ethics and content, who was the pretend owner of the Jewish Chronicle, who was in and out of Downing Street during the Tory years. The lead news anchor currently is Laura Kunzberg, who's famous for her Tory views. Before that, it was Nick Robinson, who was treasurer of the Young Conservatives. And before that, it was Jeremy Paxman, who considered standing in the 2015 election as a Tory. If you want to get somebody on to trade Palestinian supporting and communist supporters with names that I've got on my list, I'll happily take the Pepsi challenge.
Yes, that's the problem with impartiality. It completely changes the definition of it depending on who you talk to. And these days, we seem to be living in a bubble all of our own. Everybody is, with the, you know, the preponderance of social media and so on. And it seems to have got to the point that if you do not hear opinions you agree with 24 hours a day, then that institution is biased against you.
Yeah, exactly. There's the famous Newsnight case where when they were talking about Brexit and they had 99% of economists saying that it was a ridiculous idea. They had to get the lunatic Patrick Minford on and pretend that his views equalised the 99 others. And that's the pressure that they're under, and that's why it's done. It's to force the BBC to pretend that the right-wing rubbish is equal to the truth.
Yes, I mean, you can't balance every issue. You have to make judgments on some issues. You know, killing people is bad, but if you have to balance that opinion with killing people is good, then you're not really going to have time in the day to actually impart any news. Good to talk to you, Andrew. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you are on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. Do you think the BBC has been criticised unfairly here? Because they were painting a picture of Donald Trump, and they did edit his speech, because the speech that the clip came from is one of his typical rambling ones that went on for over an hour, so they couldn't put the whole thing in. So they got the what they thought was the gist of it. Was it fair to clip a bit of Donald Trump saying, fight like hell, and then show subsequently his cult fans doing exactly that. Whereas it's not quite what Donald Trump said, but the result was the same. 0345 6060 973. East Yorkshire. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Mick. Yeah, I want to focus on this Trump bit as well, because he complained that there was an implication that he'd suggested people became violent. Well, the evidence about this is that he didn't walk down to the Capitol. He went back to his office and switched his telly on.
And then stood there
watching
it.
And this is all on film.
Yeah.
And he watched it for 2 hours, and people were imploring him, his family and his aides, saying, intervene with this, stop it. And he didn't for 2 hours. So he enjoyed the fighting.
Well, we don't know that.
Well, he was quite happy not to stop it.
Well, maybe he... okay, so now you're forcing me to put the other side. Maybe he thought that he was unable to do so. And in fact, you know, some Republicans have said that it's all the fault of Nancy Pelosi for refusing to allow the National Guard to come in and save them. But, you know, other opinions are available.
Yes, I think so. And I mean, he was happy to watch the gallows and the noose going in for Mike Pence. And didn't intervene. I mean, this is ridiculous. He did eventually intervene and calmed it down. So it was possible, as was evidenced, which is not opinion about anything. It's just purely evidence.
Yeah, well, I mean, Trump is a man who has his people execute unknowns in boats off the coast of other countries. He pardons rioters even after deaths occurred. He has his goons pull people out of cars and pull children out of their beds and zip-tie them in the street. I mean, are we ready to believe that his feelings are hurt, or is this just another opportunistic attack on those that dare to report on all of that?
Yeah, he thinks he's going to have the same effect over here as what he's done to the media outlets in the States.
Yes.
But on a broader note, I mean, I would say that I don't entirely trust any broadcasters, but I broadly trust ITN, Sky, BBC. I don't trust everything because they make mistakes. They all do. They get it wrong. Occasionally. But I don't believe there's any intent there. And I just hope we do not go down the American route of Fox News, basically propaganda channels. I mean, we've got GBBs, we know, but you've got to really target it to watch that. It's not something that you will come across before the football or before after EastEnders or whatever, is it?
Yes, it's a choice that you make to watch that. It can't be an uninvited guest into your home.
No. So I think they've been a bit unlucky with all this stuff, but I think that, as your previous guest said, they don't defend themselves very well. Commercial organisations are far better at seeing what's coming and getting the defence in first.
Yes.
And
well,
fighting it.
There doesn't seem to be a culture of accepting responsibility and resigning if you get, if you make mistakes in, for instance, the newspaper industry in this country. I mean, the Independent Press Standards Organization, the regulator for most UK newspapers, publishes annual reports that contain data on upheld complaints. And the Mail Online had 15 rulings against it in 2021. It had a breach in 2022. In 2023, the Mail Online and the Telegraph tied for the most fully upheld complaints. And newspapers in general in the UK, I mean, they typically publish corrections and clarifications in print that you'd need a microscope to see, having splashed their falsehoods over the front page. And there is no recorded tally, apparently, but it's generally several per month that they have to correct, that they are forced to, and the total annually is likely to be in the hundreds, and yet, you know, their executives survive.
Yeah, and when the second report, after the hacking report came in, there was going to be a report and a suggestion on how to control newspapers, but the Tories shot that down big time. They weren't going to allow that to go through when serious control could have been put on them. I can't remember what report it was now.
Yeah.
With M.
Well, you're going to have to narrow it down just a little bit more than that for us, Mike. But I appreciate that. Thanks for that.
Okay.
0345-6060-973. So we're talking about the BBC. They seem to be in a moment of crisis. And I wonder if this is actually going to go any further than this. Or will the resignation of the DG and the head of news actually put a line under it, and then they can move forward? Because, you know, their news organisation is trusted compared with most other news outlets. I mean, people will read their favourite paper, but with more of a thought to, am I actually reading the truth here, or is this just propaganda, more so than they think of the BBC. So I guess that one of the questions is that the BBC might be losing that trust, at least with some of their viewers, presumably the ones that think that Donald Trump has never done anything wrong and has been, badly treated by the lefty liberals, the enemies of the people that you're familiar with. So is there anything that they can do to regain the trust that they have lost? 0345-6060-973. Going to take a break for the news, then come back with more of your thoughts on that. I'll also be talking to Anna Sabine, the Liberal Democrat spokesperson for culture and the MP for Frome and East Somerset. 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Director General of the BBC's resigned following new criticism of its impartiality and the editing of a speech by President Trump. Tim Davey is admitting mistakes have been made and he's taking ultimate responsibility. A super typhoon has brought wind speeds of around 140 miles per hour to the Philippines. At least two deaths have already been reported because of the storm being named Fung Wong. And a 44-year-old man accused of sexually assaulting an 8-year-old boy in the Scottish Highlands has died in prison. John Bell from Grangemouth had made no plea in court during a hearing about the allegations. LBC weather, rain, which could be heavy at times, will move north from the southwest overnight. Clear skies will develop behind it. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees.
This is LBC.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep. Where babies are made a fuss of. Where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts. And where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Followed by 11sies, brunch, lunch or dinner, then tea or dinner.
Or supper, depending where you're from.
Look, can we at least agree that breakfast is the most important meal of the day? That's why Warburton's, the family bakers, teamed up with organisations like Magic Breakfast to donate millions of breakfasts this year to schools in the UK. Good stuff. It's baked in at Warburton's. To find out more, search Warburton's Good Stuff.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345-6060-973.
So we're talking about the BBC. Tim Davey, the Director General of the BBC, has resigned, as has Deborah Turnus, the Chief Executive of BBC News. This is in relation to what is described as the mis-editing or Franken editing, as an insider described it, of the Donald Trump speech just before the riot at the Capitol building, after he lost the election. He's still determined to suggest that no such thing happened, that he did not lose the election, but I guess that's a separate issue. Let's talk about this with Anna Sabine. Anna is a Liberal Democrat spokesperson for culture and MP for Frome and East Somerset and joins us on the line. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Nick. Good to hear from you.
Thanks for joining us. What do you make of the resignations of Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus?
I think it's a difficult situation the BBC now finds itself in. I think we've always said the BBC isn't perfect, as the party, the Lib Dems, have definitely had our problems with them. But we feel it's a very important institution in our country. It's important for holding up British values. And I think we're seeing this evening by some of the reactions this news is getting from people like Trump and Farage, that these are a good reason why we need to defend it in an age of misinformation.
Yes. Do you think that they're being treated too harshly on this issue? Because, you know, just the news channel itself is about 9,500 hours of mostly live TV per year. I mean, it's impossible to be 100% impartial all of the time. So you are going to upset some people, particularly those on the fringes, who feel as though they're being hard done by or left out or whatever.
Yeah, and the BBC's always been criticised by left and right for being too far left and right. And when you're being attacked on both sides, I guess that might make you think you're broadly hitting the right mark. I mean, the Lib Dems think that the BBC's fundamental. It's not just about news. It's about culture. It's about society. It's about art. And, of course, it's a huge institution and it is going to get things wrong from time to time. What's important is that these things are dealt with and cleared up, and it's clear how it's going to be avoided next time round. And I think what's worrying here is that an issue of process, clearly there was an issue with that Panorama documentary, unclear when the board didn't know about it and what they were planning on doing about it. But it's really important that issue of process isn't weaponized into becoming about something very fundamental about whether the BBC is good or bad or right or left, and that it's undermined on that basis.
Yes, do you think it is important in a programme like Panorama, which is not actually news, it's a sort of a magazine programme, that they paint a more or less correct picture about the subject that they're talking about? Or should they painstakingly make sure that every detail is correct, and then by which method paint an incorrect picture of their subject?
I mean, I think that the Panorama thing's interesting, and I'm not across all the details, so I'm slightly wary, but I mean, I don't think they were painting an impression of Trump that was wrong. Trump, you know, I would think there's a strong argument that Trump wasn't citing poor behaviour on the 6th of January, but that's not really the issue for me. The issue for me is that if there was a decision taken by their external advisor that was poorly edited, then that needs to be raised and needs to be dealt with, and the public need to have it explained to them, and that all needs to happen in short order. I think your previous caller made the point that one of the things the BBC seems to have been bad about is how it resolves these issues swiftly and effectively, so it doesn't find itself 6 months down the road being tripped up and putting itself in a position where now much bigger existential questions are being asked about the BBC, when really that wasn't what this issue was about. It was about a process and procedure article about some editing.
Yeah, one industry insider said that he felt that the BBC's attitude was not to address the problems, but to see if they could get away with you know, what they had done, this mis-editing, essentially trying to cling on to their jobs, I guess, in a nutshell.
And that may be true, and I'm sure a lot of organisations are guilty of that. I think the Lib Dems feel that the BBC now has to use this as an opportunity to restore trust and make sure that the next appointment that comes forward does start to build that trust, and that the principles of balanced reporting and fairness aren't sacrificed to political pressure. And that's the real challenge that the BBC is facing as we sit here now.
Yeah, do you think that the government, particularly Boris Johnson, has made the position of being head of the BBC much, much more difficult than it used to be?
You're talking to someone who became an MP because she was so frustrated about the government of Boris Johnson. I mean, how difficult it was making people to feel there was even any trust in politics. So, I do think that it's very, very unfortunate how many politicians seem to feel that undermining the BBC is a good way of making a political point, when actually we really rely on the BBC. We're living in a time of misinformation. My children are teenagers. They get the majority of their news from online sources, from YouTube, and we really need organisations like the BBC and other public service broadcasters to be broadly reliable, fact-based organisations that people can come back to and check their news from. And I would really like politicians to lay off politicising it, particularly when it threatens its very existence.
Well, that's an interesting thought, that your teenage children don't get their news from the BBC. I suspect, with the possible exception of the Traitors programme, which was a runaway hit, they probably don't watch the BBC that much. And that's increasingly the case with younger people, isn't it? I think the average age of the BBC One and BBC Two viewer is over 60. So are we looking at a point where the actual institution itself, the corporation, is gradually becoming irrelevant?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if we use my children as the example, they were raised on lots of good BBC programmes, like in the Night Garden and stuff. I suspect they consume bits of the BBC that I don't know about, like Radio 1 and things that I'm far too fuddy-duddy for. But no, I don't think it's a question of it being not relevant. And I think it's a question of making sure that a body that's this important, that's a public institution, is run in a really transparent, accountable way and that people can have confidence in it. And that's what the Lib Dems are calling for this evening, is for this to be a moment of changing the BBC and a moment to try and really work on restoring that trust at a time when we need the BBC more than ever.
Yes, well, the Lib Dems are probably, with the greatest respect, not the voices that are going to be heard the loudest. Those will be from the offshore billionaire media magnates who desperately want the BBC to cease to exist because it interferes with their business model. So do you think that actually this is probably going to get worse and there's going to be a sort of a transatlantic alliance of the Trump's people and those on the right in this country who really desperately want to get rid of anything that that challenges their narrative?
Oh, I think it's happening right now. You just look at X this evening. You've got the Trump administration tweeting about what great news this is and urging people to watch GB News. You've got Farage and Rupert Lowe saying this is great news. It heralds the beginning of the end of the BBC. That axis of behaviour between those groups is here, and we've got to resist it. And actually, earlier on, I was likening this situation as being a bit like a sibling. I feel like you're allowed to be rude about your own sibling, but when someone else from outside your family starts, then that's not allowed. And I think that's how a lot of us may feel about the BBC this evening. We're allowed to criticise it as British citizens who pay our licence fee, but I don't want the Americans, because that's just an attempt to undermine a really important British institution that we hold really dear.
Good to talk to you, Anna. Thanks for that. Anna Sabine, Liberal Democrat spokesperson for Culture and MP for Frome and East Somerset. So what do you make of all this? 0345 6060 973. Is the BBC in general and the BBC News in particular something that you trust, that you value? If not, is it possible that they could regain your trust? 0345 6060 973. Bo in Bridgend. Hello, Bo.
Evening, Nick. Evening. I think Ed should have rolled on this incident, because I'm not going to make a fool of myself, but I think the Gaza where the BBC had the son of an Hamas leader, didn't they? And so,
well, he was barely into double figures, and I did not see it, but as far as I'm aware, he was just.
But it was a mistake. I think for impartiality reasons, it was a mistake. So I think, but the question for me, the big question now, Nick, because I think the BBC is under threat. This is a pivotal moment for the BBC. The next leader I want, the next director general I wanted to talk about.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I think, well, I'm a Labour supporter, but I tell you what, respected people, we need the BBC needs somebody universally respected in Britain. Dominic Grebe, Rory Stewart comes to mind. If I'm a Labour supporter, Alan Johnson. The BBC's under attack. Let's get a leader in. I think across a political spectrum, across media blogs, I think they respect it. And it's vitally important now that the BBC get somebody in. I mean, you know, there's going to be mistakes made, but let's get a leader in.
Right, that's the issue, isn't it? There's going to be mistakes made, there's no doubt about it, because, as I said before, we're human beings, we're not robots, and, human beings make mistakes. The issue for a lot of people is that the mistake wasn't confessed to immediately, and a retraction wasn't issued, and the piece wasn't re-edited, and so on. That's part of the... What some are calling is the nexus of this, of a diminution of the trust in the organisation of the BBC. All right, thanks, Bo. 0345 6060 973. Let's have Liverpool. Vincent.
Hello, Clive.
Clive's not here at the moment. I can call you back when he is.
I know. I've got your name mixed up. Sorry, Nick. Money Vincent. Hey, Nick, do you know what? Apart from Liverpool losing before you say, to be honest, The BBC have been like that for years, haven't they?
Like that? What do you mean?
Lying constantly, constantly, and constantly. It's flabbergasting. So if you get the top fellas resigning, it's not because they've turned up late, is it?
I'm not sure I really understand what you're saying. You're saying that the BBC has for years lied and lied and lied. Is that your position?
Lied and lied and lied.
About what?
About everything.
Right, OK. Well, that's not a serious position to hold, Vincent. No, they have not. 0345 6060 973. Has your trust in the BBC, particularly in their news division, been affected by this? Or do you think they have been perhaps treated unfairly and that they were painting a picture of a man, Donald Trump, quite accurately? Just they had to edit out large parts of a speech that went on for over an hour in order to present that picture. And the order of the clips that they used made it look as though Donald Trump actually told the people in front of him to go and riot in the Capitol building. Does it actually matter? Because that is actually what happened. He said, fight like hell, and then they subsequently did. Does it matter the order in which those events happened? Or the time delay from him saying it to them doing it? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. A chancellor whose numbers don't add up.
People can see that the global circumstances are challenging.
A justice secretary who seems incapable of knowing if prisoners are on the run.
I put in place the toughest checks we've ever had in the prison system.
And they still pretend the one-in, one-out deal will solve the surge in small boat crossings.
That is returning for the first time. People who arrive on small boats.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Imagine a delicious patty nestled between two buns with cheese and ketchup. It's not a burger. That patty is actually sausage, which makes this a sandwich. A breakfast sausage sandwich. The new $1.99 sausage sandwich from McDonald's. Made with RSPCA assured pork. Until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
Every investor has a future in mind. Whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So Tim Davey has announced his resignation as Director General of the BBC. In a note to staff sent this evening, he referenced the challenging circumstances in which he had led the corporation and admitted that the turmoil of the past week had prompted his departure. This is what he said. I have been reflecting on the very intense personal and professional demands of managing this role over many years in these febrile times. In this increasingly polarised times, the BBC is of unique value and speaks to the very best of us. It helps make the UK a special place, overwhelmingly kind, tolerant and curious. Like all public organisations, the BBC is not perfect and we must always be open, transparent and accountable. While not being the only reason, the current debate around BBC News has understandably contributed to my decision. Overall, the BBC is delivering well, but there have been some mistakes made, and as Director General, I had to take ultimate responsibility. And it's the open, transparent and accountable part of that that is being described as a failure, as the panorama edit of Trump's speech made it look as though he told his crowd to go and fight, which they immediately did. Trump was talking about the fact that he thought that the election had been stolen from him, and if you don't fight, then you'll lose your country. So it was... he was lying about something, and the Panorama people sort of clipped that part out. Red Hill, Felicity. Felicity.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good, thank you. So I've been listening to LBC for most of my life, and when I was younger, I used to watch LBC all the time, absolutely all the time. I'm now in my 20s. I've gone and done the thing, gone out, left home, and for me, I find it quite hard to trust the BBC after experiencing looking at that kind of their practices with regards to things like TV license.
How do you mean? In what sense?
A lot of their letters that they come through when you don't have a TV license, and you don't wish to have a TV license, can be quite threatening. And when you do have a TV license, they can still send threatening letters, and they can be quite intimidating. And so when you have something like that as your first contact with the with the BBC, with the organisation that's in charge of it, it's quite startling. And it's like, if that's the practices that they have with regards to trying to grab people's money and trying to influence them and be quite intimidating with that factor, it makes you look, well, if that's an acceptable practice in their eyes, when it pertains to their ethics, what else are they doing that's questionable? And
well, that's a bit like saying that you're upset with the supermarket because you were asked by security, that you just set off an alarm and they wanted to look in your bag, and now you don't trust that supermarket.
I think it's quite different from that, because if I've just gone and moved in and I haven't had any contact with the supermarket, all I've done is walk in, look at the supermarket. Actually, no, I haven't even walked into the supermarket. I have no contact with the BBC. All I've done is gone home and cooked myself food, and then it's asking the security, look in my bags and look in my cupboard, have I got anything that I've stolen?
Right.
That's just me walking into my house. Walking into the supermarket.
Yeah, but these are sort of debt collection organisations, and they're separate from the actual BBC themselves. I mean, I'm sure Tim Davey had no control over how many letters you got, but that made you distrust the output of the BBC. That seems a bit odd.
Makes me distrust them, because I think that they should be more of a subscription model rather than actually having a situation where you're both expected to pay TV license, to pay to fund the BBC.
But that's the whole nature of the organisation, though, isn't it? If it was a subscription model, then it wouldn't be doing, I'd suggest, 80% of what it does at the moment. It would just be all copies of what is available on a commercial station. Now, I know they do a lot of that, but the BBC do a massive amount of things that other commercial competitors wouldn't dream of doing, because it doesn't make money. But they do have value as, you know, art or information, you know, education and so on.
I feel like forcing people to participate in this by the way that they are, if it's not them directly, they're allowing people to act on that on behalf of their organisation, on behalf of the way their subscription models are. So if they're condoning that on companies that they want to associate with, I would make them just as bad as the companies they choose to associate with.
But how are they to collect the licence from people who don't want to pay but want to use the service?
You lock it out. You make sure that it's a login. You make sure that you have to actually sign up for it, and like they have done with the websites and all of that stuff, which is absolutely fine. If that's what they've done, so you have to sign in, you have to create a login. If you haven't signed in, if you haven't got a login, you aren't able to access their services. If you haven't paid, you can't access their service.
Right. Okay. All right. Interesting to talk to you. Thanks, Felicity. Let's see, messages, texts and others. Barry says, impartial means showing both sides of the argument rather than showing bias. If the BBC is upsetting everyone, then it is being impartial. Cardiff, hello, Peter.
Hi, Nick. Is the BBC biased? Well, human nature, we're all biased, and I think sometimes but we've got to be careful what we wish for. you know, and criticism from America's elite should be a badge of honor. A country that produces Fox News and some of the talk radio chaps, you know, we've got a version of that with GB News here. No, it needs radical reforming, and I think that needs to be done from the top. It needs someone in there willing to, talk to power properly, investigate properly, without fear or favour. I think I don't watch BBC News because of it's gone tame. And I was saying to your producer,
tame.
I remember
tame. What do you mean tame?
Tame. Well, you watch the news now, and some of the stuff that goes on. Let's go back. Labour get elected. They come in on a promise of all sorts of wonderful things they're going to do for. And the first thing they do is attack our old age pensioners, which I'm one, by the way. But they attack the old age pensioners' money.
That's one way of putting it, but another way of putting it was they were trying to obviate the need to give those older people that don't need, requiring government money. They were trying to save money by not giving it to them. I mean, why should somebody who is 20, who can't afford their own home, be subsidising a millionaire pensioner, example?
That's an extreme example.
Well, yes.
Exactly.
Well, that's my point. Well, why should they?
Well, that's an extreme example. What they actually did was say to everybody on pension, you're not having it.
Well, no, they didn't.
Well, I think they brought in some pretty extreme criteria, didn't they? You had to be on the old pension or have less than 12,000 a year coming in.
Didn't seem extreme to the younger people who can't afford a roof over their heads, and they can't afford food, and they don't have enough money to even have children, and et cetera, and so on. But you see what we're doing, Peter? We're both sizing it.
We're both sizing, and we're falling into that trap that is laid very carefully by these news channels, by these people, by the Farages of the world. Let's blame. When in reality, you and I worked all our lives, you and I paid into our national insurances for the then pensioners. I didn't bark about it. And anybody that thinks a pension of £200 a week, when they're paying £140 a week rent in some places, is a lot.
Okay. I understand all that, but I fear we are getting off the point a bit. But I appreciate the call, Peter. Thanks for that. Tavistock. Hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. I just think this is these are trivia in the context of the magnificence of the organisation we have. And you won't remember why should you, but I do have a big beef about somebody they got rid of, and I won't go into that. But even so, you know, it seems absolutely ridiculous. The sheer quality of the thing. You've got the World Service, you've got the music, you've got the news, and you have presenters who are able to get themselves out of the way in order to serve the thing that they're there to present, whether it's the music or the musicians who come in, or whether it's the news. And this is a huge skill, and you won't get it that good anywhere else. You just won't.
No, well,
ego-free presenters.
Yes, there is truth in that. The BBC does do things that commercial competitors don't do, and if we were to lose the BBC, then we would get all of our information from the Rupert Murdochs of the world. The barbarians would be invading front rooms. So I think we should be very careful about what we wish for. But, you know, the right wing, the Farages and the Trump's people and the intersection between those two groups are seeing this opportunity as, one of a lifetime. And they will no doubt be digging up anything they possibly can in order to make us more and more appalled at the BBC, which is one of the most trusted organisations in the country, along with our NHS. and is one of the few things that actually differentiates us from our competitor countries, the NHS, the Royal Family, and the BBC. Rose, we're going to have to cut it short, unfortunately, but there will be more opportunities to talk about this topic perhaps later on this show, and most certainly later on LBC. We're going to change it up after the news. Debating, apparently, will become compulsory, a compulsory part of the national curriculum, front and centre of many subjects. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, says this will stop public speaking being the preserve of private schools, with them often being viewed as better at developing oracy skills in pupils. One survey showed that 53% of private schools had a debating club, compared with 18% of state schools. Did you debate at school? If you didn't, do you feel like it impacted your life? And will this move help to balance a class divide? 0345 6060 973. Let's debate debating.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says the resignation of the Director General of the BBC and his Chief Executive of News shows the pair have taken responsibility for failings at the corporation. Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus are stepping down ahead of an expected apology over the way a Donald Trump speech filmed on the day of the Capitol riot was edited. Stuart Purvis was a journalist and executive at the media regulator Ofcom. He's been telling LBC the Trump edit is significant.
Congress of the United States had an inquiry, and they searched long and hard for a killer quote which proved that Trump absolutely incited that riot, and they couldn't actually find it. The BBC found it because they made it happen. They actually edited it to sound that way. So, I mean, that is the severity of what the person in that edit suite did that day.
The BBC has also been facing pressure over its coverage of the war in Gaza, a broadcast from the Glastonbury Festival, and allegations of political bias. Tim Davey says his decision to resign is not just down to the President Trump's speech. Richard Tate is a professor of journalism at Cardiff University. He's been telling Nick Abbott on LBC the corporation's found itself in a new landscape and a difficult position.
And I think that what's happened in the BBC currently is that they're trying to accommodate a world where impartiality is not accepted by quite significant minorities of the audience. The core audience does.
There are warnings the health service is facing a collision of flu and doctor strikes as it heads into the winter. The chief executive of NHS England says the next five-day walkout by resident doctors there could pose a significant challenge. Sir Jim McKay thinks it will probably coincide with bad flu. And the King has led the nation in a two-minute silence during the annual Remembrance Sunday commemorations in central London. He laid a wreath at the cenotaph in recognition of those who'd made the ultimate sacrifice during conflicts. Mervyn Kirsch served during the D-Day landings in 1944 and was in Whitehall.
If you don't remember, you're not alive. You learn nothing. The main lesson that I would teach is that bullies don't attack anyone who's stronger than them. In other words, defence is opposed to.
LBC weather, rain, which could be heavy at times, will move north from the southwest overnight. Clear skies will develop behind it. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC, from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
In a forthcoming change to the school curriculum, classroom debating will become commonplace in most subjects rather than the preserve of private schools. This is what the Education Secretary has said. Private schools, which can deviate from the national curriculum, have often been viewed as better at developing debating and oracy skills in pupils through group discussions, regular presentations and debates. There are minimal spoken language requirements for children aged 11 to 14 in some subjects in state schools, and in particular subjects that they are apparently non-existent. Let's talk about this with Christine Cunniff. Christine is principal at LVS Ascot School and author of the book Transforming School Culture. Hello, Christine.
Hello, good evening.
Do you think this is the sort of thing that could transform school culture?
I'm a little bit sort of taken aback by it, really. I've taught in both the state and independent sectors, and I think all good teaching should involve some form of debate within the classroom anyway. And as far as I'm concerned, I've been teaching for over 30 years. It's there anyway. So if it's not happening, that's a teaching and learning issue rather than a curriculum issue.
Right, so you think that the government is busy fixing a problem that doesn't exist?
Yeah, and again, it seems to be critical of the independent sector again as well. You know, a government that's just taxed parents on taxpayer money to send their children to private school. So rather than actually, you know, look at it as a good thing, if it is a preserve of the independent sector, which I don't think it is, let's see how that's done and make sure the rest of the country think. But I think it's a bit of an insult to state school education, actually.
But is it not the case that that private schools do instill a certain level of confidence in their pupils that is absent in many of the pupils of state schools? And part of that is to prioritise the ability to hold court, if you like.
But then I'd ask why. Why is that happening? Why are children not given the confidence or opportunity to develop those that confidence? It shouldn't be for some and not others. It should be the part of everyday school life. If I went back into the state sector now, I would hope that I'd be doing exactly the same thing as what I'm doing now.
And do you think that the sort of attainment of grades and this this competition between state schools to you know, get a better grade than the others, that has led to a deprioritization of anything that doesn't actually improve their grades, as in, you know, the qualifications the actual the pupils themselves leave school with, and debating is a difficult thing to actually mark, so it's not part of their consideration.
Yeah, I think the way the exams are going to go as well, if we look at AI and the way exams are becoming more digitalised, and I've seen this with, I'm saying children, young adults in universities at the moment, a lot of the examinations in the future might be backed up by those person face-to-face Viva-type backup for the work that they've actually produced. So it is important, and it's going to have to be the skills that are developed.
Right, so at the moment, it's gone almost completely written or typed, I suppose, and it sort of feeds into the lack of verbal communication that seems to be endemic in the young. They're sort of staring at their phones all day and appear unreluctant, or reluctant rather, to actually use their mouths to communicate. They're just doing it with their thumbs.
Yeah, I mean, there's another debate about schools banning mobile phones. They're banned during the day in my school, and the majority of schools that I know, actually. But there is a tendency for children to shy away to their devices, but the best conversations are done at home around the dining room table. And so parents got to play a part of that as well, and put phones away and actually have a chat with the children.
That's becoming increasingly difficult to do, though, isn't it? I mean, try taking a phone away from a child, and you'll be met with a stern response.
I know, but that's part of parenting, isn't it? I mean, when mine were younger, it was, you know, moving away from the toy aisles all the time. So you've got to put your foot down and say, no, this is time we're actually going to talk to each other. Let's listen to the news, let's listen to LBC, let's listen to a debate. And what do you think about that afterwards?
Do you think that much of this is about actual debating skills, or is it instilling confidence in pupils to speak in public as a sort of bag of tricks to present yourself forcefully to win an argument, even if you're wrong?
I think, again, it's not about winning an argument forcefully. It's been able to just stand up and defend your position and why. And that comes with a good education, because if you've got the confidence and the stats behind you and the knowledge, you should be able to challenge anybody in the right way, because you have that knowledge and confidence and understanding.
And do you think that the world of work is actually moving in the opposite direction? I mean, aren't debating skills the preserve of yesterday's workplace? Today's office workers, they email each other, even if they're sitting on the same desk.
Yeah, and that in itself causes problems, because we know that there's a lot of miscommunication through email. We may see a swing in the future, and there's always going to be some professions where it's done, you know, a lot of people work remotely now and don't need those skills. But saying that, I think it's good in everyday life, even if you've got to contest your electricity bill or, you know, a problem that you might have in, elsewhere in life. You need to develop that confidence to be able to stand your ground.
Well, that's an interesting example. Contest your electricity bill. I think these days, actually, you would be contesting it with a robot. I mean, try talking to an actual human being and you'll be disappointed.
Yeah, but me, after 30 years of teaching, I'm not having that. I want to speak to a human being as I go down your complaints procedure. And I think these are it's the confidence to be able to do that. I am not prepared to accept that, and I want to go one step further and know how to do that, because you do have rights.
Yeah, as AI progresses and the promises of its proponents start to become realised, they're going to take the jobs that rely on specifically communication, aren't they? Are we about to prioritise in school something that will be redundant quite shortly at work?
No, I think the human factors, the collaboration, creativity, critical thinking and communication, they're the human skills that AI can't actually do at the moment. And remember, we're shaping that AI. We're the ones who will shape it in the future, hopefully, she says. And so therefore, I think, you know, developing those human skills, which mean communicating, being able to talk with each other and be express ourselves, whether that's digitally or verbally, is just so important.
It's odd then that they're talking about debating skills, because that seems to implies, you know, a sort of a move towards political debating skills. And is there any correlation between being a good public speaker and being a charlatan who uses the tricks of presentation to con others into believing things that aren't true? I mean, it seems to be an indicator in politics of that. The biggest proponents of division and lies and fake news seem to be the best performers.
Well, I think life is a performance, isn't it? Then what about what you do? You know, if you can actually come across well, I still believe that you are going to find yourself in optimal situations. And it's a shame that debate, the word debate, is actually attached to politics, because that's not what it's about. It's having the ability to talk or debate, talk, converse with somebody else within the room or group of people to express yourself.
And do you think that that is being lost then?
Well, I don't see it. I really don't. But saying that, there are schools at the moment that struggle with teacher recruitment. There are lots of digital lessons out there and less interaction, I think, with teachers, because we can't recruit teachers into the profession. That's the bottom line at the end of the day.
And what do you make of the new curriculum in general? I mean, they're focusing on sciences, more emphasis on religious education, AI, financial literacy, climate change. Where's the art in all that? The stuff that makes life a joy, music, design, applied arts, concrete, figurative arts, acting, dancing, all the things a robot can't do.
Yeah, I think, again, having worked in an independent school for over 20 years now, where we've had the freedom to have a curriculum that fits best for our children. And that doesn't mean it stays the same every year either. We see certain groups coming up through the years, and we can change and adapt and provide all those opportunities. The problem is with a fixed curriculum is it's not going to give a breadth of experience to the child, and it's also going to be dependent on whether you can recruit into those areas as well. So we're talking about teaching about AI as a fixed point in time, because I think it was even mentioned about having an A-level. It's got to be part of the culture of the school, right from an early age, that we have to use AI, we have to work alongside it. But losing the art, the music, is just disastrous. I'm a musician by trade, and I think a lot of my skills and my confidence has been developed through that.
Right, and is that something that you think is lacking in state schools, perhaps because of a lack of funding?
It's not only a lack of funding. I think there's plenty of teachers out there willing to do it, but it's also cost a lot of money as well. And I suppose when there's league tables and you're actually determined by a piece of paper that ranks you, I think schools are going to be looking to spend their money where they're going to get that return on those core exam results. It's such a shame, really. League tables, do not believe in them.
Okay. Well, how else would a parent decide which school to send their child to if they don't have, you know, a number that suggests that one school is better than the other?
Well, if you look at, and I'm not running down any school at all in this, But if I took the top 10% of the population to come to my school, I'd be at the top of league tables. I would have a string of A's and A stars. But it doesn't necessarily prove that my school's any better. Schools should be measured on what they call value added. So children, wherever they are in their journey, they're given a curriculum where they can thrive. And the parent will know when they walk into school, talk to the children, look at the atmosphere, talk to the staff, they'll know that that's the school for their child.
Good to talk to you, Christine. Thanks very much for
Thank
that.
You.
Christine Cunniff, principal at LVS Ascot School and author of the book Transforming School Culture. So, what do you make of that, this classroom debating to become commonplace in most subjects under the new national curriculum? I was under the impression that that's what happened in school, that teachers stood at the front, asked questions, kids put their hand up, and gave the answer that they thought most appropriate. Is that not debating? And then they'd be, ribbed by their mates or applauded as appropriate. But the government seems to think that it is something that needs to be addressed. And what do you make of this concentration on the sciences and English and I've lost the list. I had it a moment ago. The studies of religious education and AI and financial literacy and things like that. It seems a bit dry, doesn't it? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers on my birthday. And 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
Are you a London black cab driver thinking of ways to boost your earnings during those quieter times? Why not consider Uber? We can give your meter a wake-up call. Join close to 1,000 black cab drivers already on Uber. Black cabs on Uber are priced by your meter, and the service fee will be no more than 5% until the end of 2025. Turn downtime into prime time. Go to uber.com/blackcabs to start earning today. Terms and conditions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So secondary schools are going to have a new curriculum. It's going to be introduced September 2028. It'll include a raft of changes, including a triple science GCSE as standard, and more emphasis on religious education and focus on financial literacy and climate change. And debates, or classroom debating, will become more commonplace in most subjects. Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, said, in a world and workplace increasingly enabled by technology and AI activities that build children's ability to communicate, to construct an argument and work collaboratively, are critical to boosting life chances. That seems counterintuitive. I mean, as AI advances, our ability to communicate with each other will recede, surely. I mean, isn't that evident from the advancement of AI at the moment? The smartphone in our pockets has made everybody under the age of 30 use their mouth less. Bridget Phillipson said, through our curriculum reforms, we will make classroom debating, too often the preserve of those who can afford a private education, the common entitlement of a generation. Well, is that not what class... I mean, maybe the school classroom has changed significantly since I was a kid, but it used to be that debating was part of it. You sat there and you listened to the teacher, and then he asked a question, or she asked a question, you put your hand up, and a debate ensued. But perhaps that's not what she's talking about. Maybe it's this sort of competitive debating that we've become used to seeing on our phones, which is debating in the sense that the professional wrestling is a sport. It's not really. It's more like entertainment, forcefully putting forward your view by means of the tricks that you learn in doing so. Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, says from stretching our brightest pupils to building critical skills among those who are disengaged, embedding oracy right across our curriculum, I don't know why I have such a hard time with that word, it will enable every child to find their voice and step into life and work with confidence. Well, people have said in the past that confidence is the thing that private schooling does tend to give its pupils. So maybe that's the it of it. Southend, hello, John.
Hello, Nick.
John.
Yes.
Yes, John, what would you like to say?
Well, I went to a comprehensive school when we didn't have anything like debated societies, and I didn't even know what a university was when I left school. But luckily, there were many jobs around for me to go to, and I was lucky to get an electrical apprenticeship with a large company in Southend at the time, and I've done very well over time. But I think nowadays, if I was to leave school again now, without sort of the debating skills that they're talking about now, I'd be in trouble.
Really? As an electrician?
That wasn't how I ended up in my career. I started off with doing an electrical apprenticeship, but then at the time we had no computers.
Mm.
And throughout my career, computers and robotic systems came along. And at the end of my career, right, I'm now, I've paid my taxes for 50 years, from 16 to 66. So it's 50 years of paying taxes. And in that time, there's been a complete transformation in the way we work. And throughout that time, I was lucky to be involved with computers all the time and finished now, I'm retired. And that's how we are. But the acceleration is so great, we just can't keep up. I couldn't keep up now.
Yes, there's been a revolution in the way we communicate in those years, most
yes.
certainly. But the fundamental way in which humans communicate is by using our mouths, even as, you know, many of us are obsessed with staring at our phones all day. We still have to talk to each other every now and again. And that
yes.
that surely hasn't changed. And it seems odd that the government would be prioritising this unless they are addressing that particular issue, that they're trying to get kids from being obsessed with their phones to actually talking to each other again. But should that actually be the preserve of schools, or should parents be wrenching those phones out of their kids' hands to sort of force them to talk to each other?
I think you're right, yes. I believe that's... Yes, that's right, yes. We should talk to each other. I mean, that is something that I definitely think is the right way to go, yes.
All right, good to talk to you, John. Thanks for that. 0345-6060-973. Do you think that debating is something that should be specifically prioritised in school, or is it something that you recognise as just being an ordinary part of school life? I mean, it can't be that pupils sit in complete silence these days. I mean, I know they talk to each other less than previous generations because of the addiction of mobile phone communication. But they must—they surely haven't lost the ability to communicate, have they? Chelsea, hello, Mark.
Oh, yes, hi, hello. What I just wanted to quickly tell you is I've now noticed two quick changes in society. So if you go into a five-star expensive hotel wearing a T-shirt with holes in and jeans with holes in, everybody assumes you're absolutely filthy rich. If you're wearing a suit and a tie, it means you're sort of at best an estate agent or a doorman or a bouncer or a chauffeur. Similarly with literacy or oracy, major illiterate rich people, highly qualified, sometimes maybe foreign, but doing billions of millions of pounds in deals with private equity, the emails are illiterate, will send, maybe sending, you know, high sulfur content crude oil. It's the deal and what you're doing that counts. In my day, it was a matter of life and death where you put the apostrophe. So oracy is actually now irrelevant. And just before you, Dean Dunham, the man's an expert. He's a god. He knows the law inside out. I would have been beaten for speaking like him at my school because he said, was you driving the car? It's now, thank God, because the class obsession, the other one being the race obsession here, maybe is being eroded. It doesn't matter how you pronounce your vowels. And as far as debate is concerned, it basically means like parliamentary debate. The other side is putting this case, you're putting this case. It's also irrelevant because Shakespeare and Dickens could come out of the grave and go on X and put the case for trans rights. The algorithms are going to screw them. It doesn't matter how you speak or write now. You see what I'm saying?
It's yes, about power. No, I understand what you're saying, that this obsession with being correct with your language is something that's in our rearview mirrors.
It used to mean money,
to a certain extent.
Because only the rich would be taught.
Right.
So if you were a window cleaner, you'd be called blimey. But now, look at the geezer who owns Pimlico Plumbers. it doesn't matter now. Now it's something you can be vulgar as hell. Doesn't matter.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Mark. I mean, haven't humankind's greatest advancements been made by people who did not debate their work? They just did it. I mean, look at the richest people in the world. They're almost all tech bros. And if you've ever heard them speak, the richest people in the world seem barely verbal. It's actually painful to listen to them. If you've ever heard Elon Musk talk, it's excruciating. The man can barely finish a sentence. And the echoing silences that he throws in the middle as he tries to quiet the noise in his head or whatever is going on there, it's painful. And it doesn't seem to have done him any harm. Not financially, anyway. 0345-6060-973. Concert, Sean.
Oh, man, I tell you what it is. If I was in Parliament, I wouldn't understand what I was bloody on about, mate.
You wouldn't
understand. You know what I mean?
You wouldn't understand yourself.
I'm not Boris Johnson, like. I'm not that bad, like. But at the end of the day, if I stood up and said, oh, look, I want this done, what the hell's he on about? I hate posh people.
That's a bit of a sweeping statement, Sean. Not all of them,
really,
surely.
I really think it's a soap, mate. It's like a soap on television. Oh, you've got to put this voice on. You've got to put the smog.
Yeah, people like that. It's a performance, yes. But certain politicians are acting. Yeah, you could put Mogg in that category, I think. And you could put Boris Johnson, of course, Farage. It seems as though that is the way of debate these days. It's an act, a performance. And unfortunately, we got ourselves into a position politically that that's what we require now. We demand to be entertained. And if you do entertain, then you can pretty much get away with anything. The amount of calls that I had during the COVID era, when I was lambasting Boris Johnson's latest error, and with people saying, leave him alone, he's doing his best. Now, you can only get that response if you have a good act, if you are a good debater. And I think that's part of it. Political debating is not really debating at all. It's verbal combat, isn't it? So it seems an odd thing to have brought out to concentrate on the new curriculum in secondary schools. It'll come in September 2028. But I guess if the government is deliberately trying to address the problem that teenagers do seem to be lost in their phones and seem uncomfortable with actually speaking to each other, or certainly strangers, then I guess it might be worth addressing. Maidstone. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Nick. Oh, this is a frustrating conversation. The point of teaching oracy, I can't even say it, I'm that frustrated, is not to learn to debate. It is to enable people to learn how to order their thinking and create an argument, to give them the confidence to communicate more effectively. So, we talk about these kids being trapped on their phones or responding to everything that they see on a video by hitting a like button. if we had people who were able to take in information, think about what they wanted, how they wanted to respond, and then construct a response, we'd be far better off. And it's really important, because if we're going to have the AI revolution, and if we're going to become more digital, you have to have critical thinking. And one of the things you need for critical thinking is the language skills to construct your argument.
Yes, I would. It's odd, isn't it? Because people talk about the lack of concentration. Got the concentration of a goldfish. They just flit about mentally and can't land on anything for any long period of time. And yet, some of the most successful podcasters in the world, who are making hundreds of millions of pounds, put out podcasts that's just talking heads for hours.
I agree with you. And and one of the reasons that all those universities and private schools used to teach rhetoric and debating wasn't because they were all going to go off and be lawyers and judges. It was because they wanted these people to have a level of confidence with how they communicated. And I think it would be a really good idea if everybody had access to that, not just the classes that can afford to send their children to expensive schools.
Yes, but hasn't it always been the case that you have to go through that process of ordering your thought before answering the question in the classroom, and that has and that surely hasn't changed? I mean, the fundamentals of teaching haven't changed in the last 50 years, have they? You impart knowledge, you ask a question to see whether the pupils have taken it on board, and whoever gets picked to answer has to, order their thoughts and present their case. That's always been the case, isn't it?
No, it hasn't been. Since the Gove reforms, there's been so much change in what we are teaching children and why. We teach to the exam from when children are at primary school. So whereas probably in your generation and my generation, you could go into any subject and the teacher would have the space to open up a debate, and that's how we learned. Many kids now don't get that because they have the curriculum they need to get through, they need to get to all this stuff before the next set of exams comes along. So we've actually lost that in our schooling.
Right. Okay, good talk to you, Rob. Thanks for that. More opportunities to talk about this later on in the hour. We're going to go for the news. Then we're going to talk about this. Another manhunt's on the way following another prisoner who's absconded from Wandsworth Jail. We'll speak with a journalist who used to be a prisoner at that same place. But first, the headlines with Tim Daly.
President Trump has accused the former director general of the BBC and his former chief executive of news of being dishonest people. He's been writing online following the resignations of Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus. It's thought the corporation will apologise tomorrow over the editing of a Donald Trump speech. There are warnings the health service is facing a collision of flu and doctor strikes as it heads into the winter. The chief executive of NHS England says the next five-day walkout by resident doctors there could pose a significant challenge. And the UK is sending military experts and equipment to Belgium after a spate of drone sightings near airports. They led to flights being grounded in Brussels during last week. LBC weather: rain, which could be heavy at times, will move north from the southwest overnight. Clear skies will develop behind it. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees.
This is LBC.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Ah, what a hotel. The pool, the breakfast, the vibe. Perfect. And the best part, you didn't overpay because you checked Trivago. On Trivago, you can compare hotel prices from multiple different sites and save up to 40%. Same hotel, just at a great price. Check Trivago to compare prices and save up to 40%. Hotel Trivago.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, It's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crispin with Walker's. Delicious.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
A Palestine Action protester who was temporarily freed from jail to go to his brother's wedding has failed to return to Wandsworth Prison, apparently. Police are searching for Sean Middleborough, who was being held on remand at HMP Wandsworth. It's understood he was granted bail by a judge to attend his brother's wedding, but has not gone back. Middleborough was charged over an alleged plot by activists to disrupt the London Stock Exchange by chaining themselves to the building. So perhaps not the most dangerous inmate at Wandsworth, but another example of a less than secure sector. Let's talk about this with David Shipley. David is a former HMP Wandsworth inmate and investigative journalist who focuses on crime and justice and writes for various publications, including The Spectator, The Times and The Telegraph. Hello, David.
Hi there.
So what do you put this down to, this slew of accidental releases, or those that were released not being trusted to return?
Well, I think what's important here is to recognise that there is an overall problem in the prison service, and each individual early release or accidental release has its own particular reasons. In some cases, the prison's got it wrong. In some cases, the court sent the wrong paperwork. We learned in one case last week. In this scenario, it seems that the court has decided to grant bail to someone who they trusted would return after he'd attended this wedding, and he's decided not to. I feel a little bit more sympathetic for the judge and for the prison in this case, because that might be harder to predict, assuming they followed proper policy. But actually, what we're going to look at is the whole system here. Why does the system struggle to keep people in jail? You know, that is the fundamental job of a prison, and our system is struggling.
Well, that's an odd way of putting it. You don't mean that people are allowed to escape. It's that the issue here is, and the reason that we're talking about this, is that people have been accidentally released.
Yes, exactly. Well, actually, it happens in both directions. So we often see situations where people are unlawfully held past the end of their sentence as well, which the public are perhaps less concerned about. It doesn't feel like a safety issue, but actually it points to the same chaos. You know, if a prison doesn't know when it's supposed to hold someone until, that's a problem. And this is a issue we find across the whole prison system. So for me, it's a failure in the leadership of the prison service.
Is it also a failure in the as far as the support that the prison service has been given over the last, let's say, 20 years by the various governments?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. I think we have to recognise that there was massive underfunding, particularly in the last decade during austerity, and we saw a lot of experienced prison officers leaving as a result. So the prison service frontline staff are much less experienced on average than they were 10 years ago. But actually, you know, it shouldn't take lots of funding or new buildings or very experienced staff to only release people when it's time for them to be released, you know, to correctly calculate a sentence and then to hold someone until the end of that sentence. That is a pretty basic job. And the fact that it isn't happening across the whole system, again, suggests to me that there's a failure at the leadership level within the prison service, which we need to address.
Right. But it's not a new phenomenon, though, is it? I mean, people are writing this up as though it is a specific problem to Labour. I mean, the number of errors has increased lately, but am I right in thinking that that's because of the early release scheme, which has crossed over with the inexperienced prison officers, as you've just described, and the overcrowding and everything that goes with that?
Well, we do know, so you're absolutely right that there have been releases in error for a very long time, and it used to run at about 50 to 60 or 70 a year. It has spiked very hard in the last couple of years. Certainly, the Ministry of Justice is trying to encourage us to conclude that this is because of the early release schemes, especially SDS 40. I'm not entirely convinced that's the case, because if you go back and look at the volume of releases per quarter, it was much, much higher a decade ago. So they're not actually, as were the new arrivals in prison, so they're not dealing with more people coming in and out than they were 10 years ago. And I think what the test will be is when we see the figures for this year, which lots of people, including me, are trying to winkle out of the Ministry of Justice with Freedom of Information requests. If this year's figures are trending higher than last year's, and they can't blame SDS 40 or any of the other early releases, and there will, in fact, be clearly a different problem going on, I suspect that will be the case. I'm not actually convinced that it's due to the early releases.
For those that don't know, what is it that a prison officer has to do to facilitate the release of somebody, whether it is by early release or not? Because it seems odd that it could happen at all.
Yes, it's quite a complicated process. So no one should be released from prison unless they have had generated what are called discharge papers, which will have been produced by the offender management unit within the prison, which actually isn't staffed by prison officers, it's staffed by civilian staff, generally. And they will have produced something which says that on the 1st of December 2025, we have to release John Smith. And you know, this is they'll generate what's called a license for him, so the conditions of his release. And then when that paperwork makes its way through the prison, the prison should go and find the correct John Smith in their cell. They should bring them to reception. They should run through checks to make sure they are indeed sitting with the correct John Smith, which might sound silly, but actually there often have been cases where a man with the same name has been released instead of the person who was supposed to be released. So, you know, if you're a John Smith or a Mohammed Khan, you are perhaps more likely to be released in error in our prison service. So they're supposed to run through checks, including biometric checks. So when I was at Wandsworth, everyone who was released from there had to have their fingerprints electronically scanned to make sure it was the correct person. And now, because of David Lammy's new rules, there are extra checks for foreign nationals being released, including the duty governor, so the person in charge of the prison that day, having to personally check and approve each release. So there are supposed to be all these layers of process, but we know, for example, that the Algerian man, who was released the week before last in error, he had all of David Lammy's new checks applied and was still released in error. In this case, it was because a court hadn't sent the paperwork to the correct jail, because the system itself had lost track of where this man was and what prison he was at. So that this is a kind of level of dysfunction, which I think people don't really understand unless they've been in the prison system. But it really is, it shouldn't go wrong. It should be a foolproof process. And that it goes wrong so regularly, I think, shows there's a real problem.
Yeah, and is the problem just simple, underfunding? I mean, the entire justice system was underfunded by the Tories over their 14 years in power by about 30% of what was needed. I mean, you can see it in the police. They lost a lot of experienced officers and then in a panic had to try to, you know, revivify the numbers, and by which method they were just bringing in all sorts of people who were unsuited to the task, with the terrible things that happen that we are familiar with. And it's the same that is happening in the as far as prison officers are concerned, and the courts, and the entire justice system has been sort of dismantled under Conservative rule, and now, of course, they're at the head of the queue, blaming it all on Labour.
Yeah, I think much of our state capacity was damaged over the last 15 years through underfunding and through losing people who were capable and knew what they were about, and a lot of institutional knowledge being lost. But also, I think the prison service particularly has a special kind of dysfunction. It's got a really peculiar management culture where the senior leadership within Petit France, where the headquarters are very controlling. So they won't allow individual prison governors to really run their jails. They try to direct every single step centrally. And when you speak to, you know, governors on conditions of anonymity and senior civil servants there on condition of anonymity, they talk about this culture of fear and a kind of learned helplessness which has been created amongst those who run our jails. So I think there's as with lots of things, it's often complicated. Absolutely, the prison service was damaged by austerity, hugely damaged. And, you know, we've seen the whole justice system has been damaged, which creates more work for the prison service, because if there's more, you know, more people being arrested and so on, there's more work for the courts, more work for the jails. So all of that's true. And also, though, the people, the senior civil servants ultimately responsible for running the prison service, who have been there across Labour and Tories, I think are demonstrably not up to the task. And I don't actually blame, I don't blame David Lammy, I don't blame Siobhan Mahmood, I don't blame Alex Chalk. I think it's on a day-to-day basis, the prisons are being controlled and run by senior civil servants who have produced a really toxic management culture, which is destructive to good functioning prisons.
Well, the alternative to having them run by senior civil servants is to have them run by private enterprise. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, oddly, so conceptually, I guess I would be opposed to private prisons. But actually, if you look at how they are, they're all inspected by the same prison inspectorate. And what seems to come across is actually the private prisons seem to do a better job. They function a bit better. They seem to have more basic humanity going on in terms of how they treat prisoners as well. And I think if you talk to people who've been in our prisons, they generally echo that. And also the people who go and inspect them, and if you read the reports, it's clear that actually the private prisons seem to be running a little bit better. We wouldn't actually need to, I'm not saying we don't have to have any civil servants running the prison service. I think what's unusual about the prison service is that it has almost no civil servants from other parts of the civil service. It's very, very insular. And I think it would benefit from bringing in some new blood from, you know, from the Home Office, from maybe from policing, maybe from education. Let's, you know, bring in people with experience who could apply at the prisons and maybe try and shake things up a bit. Or indeed, we could hire prison administrators from other European countries and maybe bring in some additional expertise that way.
Is the better functioning of private prisons partly explained by they are relatively new facilities?
That does help, you know, but I think you can have a terrible prison in a new building, and you can have a really good prison in an old building. It obviously is more pleasant, and perhaps things like, you know, the electricity and the plumbing work and that sort of thing. And private prisons did receive more funding per prisoner initially, but for the last 4 or 5 years, their funding has been equalised per prisoner with the state-run prisons. I think really it's probably mostly that those private prisons have more operational independence, and they are able to dismiss poor-performing people much more quickly, and the directors, the people who run private prisons, have much more freedom to run things in the way they think will work for their jail, for their staff, and for their inmates. And because of the control freakery in HMPPS, the prison service, I think the state-run prisons don't really have that same freedom.
Yes, of course, they have private prisons in America, and as far as I'm aware, America is one of, if not the country that tops the list for incarcerating more of its population per head than any other. And the suspicion is that they're doing it because it makes a lot of money. So we might that actually not be where we want to go?
Yeah, I think the US prison system is very, very different. And private prisons there do operate very differently and do seem to actively make profit by driving up incarceration rates and by holding on to prisoners longer. The way private prisons work here is very different. You know, anyone who's jailed is still released in the same way, whether they're in a private prison or a state-run prison. And, you know, the private prison doesn't have the ability to hold them up. And also people in our prison system move between public and private prisons during their sentence journey. It's just sort of it's treated as one system, just where some jails are operated by private enterprises. So it's quite distinct, I would say, from the US model. And it's one of the things where I conceptually I'm opposed to it, but actually on the ground in reality, it does seem to produce better jails in Britain.
And of course, no jail is secure without the people that work there. And what's the morale like with the prison officers at the moment?
Yeah, it's very poor, and you're seeing that in the struggle to hire and retain. So remember, a prison officer is a pretty well paid job, reasonably these days. If you're 18 and have no qualifications, you can go and become a prison officer, and you'll start on £30,000 to £40,000 a year. Which, you know, for an 18-year-old would be a decent starting salary. And yet, we are struggling to recruit. We are recruiting something like 16 or 17% of all prison staff from just two African countries, because we can't recruit domestically, and retention's really bad. And that shows you the problem with morale. I think that, you know, if people aren't staying in this job, which can be a tough job, you know, often you're dealing with violent, dangerous, unpredictable people, and without good leadership and decent conditions, people will leave, and that is what's happening. So that's the problem. Until that's fixed, the staffing crisis will continue, because it doesn't really matter if you're hiring lots of people every year if they are then, you know, going out the door straight away.
And if you had the ear of the Prime Minister, what would you be advising him to do?
I think it's time to replace key people in the leadership of HMPPS, so of the prison service, in the head office. There are a number of people who've been there for a really long time who are clearly not running a good prison system. There's a lot of people who've been rewarded for failure by failing upwards. We need to replace them, and there are better civil servants in the civil service who could come in to take on those roles. There are also, they could hire people from overseas. They could also look at even at the Scottish prison service. You know, there are other options available, but the problem for me is within Petit France, the head office, and they have to go there if they're going to start fixing things.
Good to talk to you, David. Thanks very much for that. David Shipley, former HMP Wandsworth inmate, investigative journalist focusing on crime and justice, and who writes for various publications, including The Spectator, The Times, and The Telegraph. Now we're going to take a short break. Then back to the thing that we were talking about before, which is the revised curriculum for secondary schools, which is going to add requirements to make sure that children are developing their oral skills, their debating abilities. Whether you think that's really something that the government should be concentrating on, and how that might be achieved. 0345 60609 73 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. A chancellor whose numbers don't add up.
People can see that the global circumstances are challenging.
A justice secretary who seems incapable of knowing if prisoners are on the run.
I put in place the toughest checks we've ever had in the prison system.
And they still pretend the one in, one out deal will solve the surge in small boat crossings.
That is returning for the first time. People who arrive on small boats.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
When you buy a BMW approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
When you're smiling.
Don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, we're talking about the new curriculum, which is to come in September 2028 for secondary schools. Reading and writing frameworks for secondary schools to support the new curriculum. I can't say that word. The new curriculum is going to come in September 2028. It'll include a raft of changes, including a triple science GCSE as standard, more emphasis on religious education, and more focus on media and financial literacy, AI and climate change. And in that revised curriculum, the Department of Education is expected to add more specific requirements to make sure children are developing oral skills in more subjects. A government source said, we're looking at a fairly poisonous combination of young people increasingly disengaged from education, retreating to their online world, and the growth of AI, where their phones can write whatever they need for them. We're tackling some of this retreat into digital platforms by teaching kids how to navigate mis- and disinformation and fake news in primary citizenship lessons, but we also need to cut this problem off at its source. And that points at a critical need for speaking and listening skills to be something that are no longer an optional part of kids' school experience, but a fundamental one in every classroom. What do you make of that? Vancouver. Hello, Nick.
No, hi, Nick. I'm not going to argue that kids shouldn't be taught debating skills. I ran a speech competition for our local high school about 50 years. That said, there's always this element when they talk about, you know, changing up secondary, you know, comprehensive schools and secondary schools and state schools, there's always this thing of, well, we've got to sort of emulate how the public schools operate. But we've got to make the OICs more like the TOS. And I think one of the things that Britain has to kind of look to is the TOFs are not fit for purpose, which is why Britain's falling apart.
Yes,
know?
But they've got
you don't
to,
want to be
but,
looking at...
But, sorry to interrupt, but they've got to where they are by dint of going to a private school, which has given them the confidence, even if they lack the ability.
I would argue that the confidence they have is knowing that they will never be held to account for anything, that they have a golden ticket. I think you could have put Boris Johnson into the Shoreditch secondary model, and he, knowing full well that it didn't matter what he did in life, he would always get the best jobs, the best gigs, he would always be given the best opportunities. Of course he's confident. All of the rich are confident because they know they're not held to account. You know, I don't think it's the education. I think it's their reality that gives them confidence. You know, if you were playing a game of pool and you knew that the table was sort of tilted to your favour, no matter how bad you were at the game, you'd be fairly confident of winning.
But it's a sort of a trick, isn't it? It's to appear as though you know what you're talking about, and that almost wins the game, even if you don't.
Well, it does in the UK. The trouble is, as we look at the UK economy, at the fact that Britain hasn't produced a company of scale in 100 years, whereas China, Singapore, Korea, the US are cracking out sort of top 5, top 10 companies, you know, over the last 20 years. I mean, when you look at the biggest companies that Britain has produced in sort of the world top 10, you've got BP and you've got HSBC. I'm sure they're great companies, but they were founded in the 19th century. And all of the rest were founded 20, 30, 40 years ago by middle-class, state-educated, bright kids in America and in China as well.
Yeah, it's true that you had to go... Sorry to interrupt again, but it's true that you had to go a long way down the list of the world's richest people before you find a Brit. I think there's only two in the top 50.
Yes, yes. And ironically, some of the richest Brits are also migrants from India, because again, they're not sort of have that class thing built in. Our own homegrown TOFs are incompetent, and we need to recognize that. We need to look at that and go, you know what, these people are idiots, and yes, we shouldn't be trying to copy the thing that produced them.
Right, they do have the aura of being born to rule, and in this country, more so than most, that can get you a very long way indeed. Thank you, Nick. Glasgow. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello there. I think, you know, just listening to Nick there, there's a lot of people who will literally walk into a job, and it's because they have that confidence to sell themselves. Debating in school is giving you the confidence to stand up and talk in front of somebody and sell something. And in a lot of cases in life, we've got to apply what we learn in school to the rest of your life. So you can walk in to a job interview where there are 700 people, 395 of them have the confidence to sell themselves, instead of 700 people walking into that interview being able to have the confidence to apply to sell themselves. And we did debating in school, and we had one particular teacher who was fantastic. She would say, you know, hands up if you support this, and then hands up if you don't support this. And if you supported it, you had to debate from the opposite perspective. So you had to go away and you had to literally read and you know, learn about the opposite side and sell that. And, you know, it was something we always did. You know, we always had to do presentations. We did group presentations. You know, and it wasn't just in English. It was every subject we had to present. And I think in life, we are unable to stand up for ourselves in a lot of cases because we don't have the skills to articulate or advocate for ourselves.
Yes, and the confidence and the confidence to deliver it such that people will hear.
Yeah. So if we're just letting, you know, sitting back and saying, oh, well, you know, somebody from a good school who can, you know, speak well and sell themselves is going to get the job, why bother applying? Mm. You know, we've got to take what we've learned in school and apply it in life. One example, I had been off on bereavement leave at work. But I'd been put forward, without knowing about it, I'd been put forward for a job. And I came home, or I came back to work after this week's bereavement leave with 48 hours to prepare for a presentation. I was very lucky that I had two managers who helped me kind of get my head around this obscure presentation subject. And then I was left to do it. And I had 48 hours and I had to pull back on everything I'd learned in school and through uni and everything to prepare this in 48 hours. And I got the job.
Oh.
And a little bit down the road, we were given feedback on our interview presentations.
Hmm.
And I, you know, they were giving feedback on what we could learn from. And my feedback was, your presentation was flawless.
Huh.
And we can't give you any negative feedback.
Well,
and all I did was pull back on what I got from school.
Yes.
And in these days where children are in echo chambers and they're basically,
they're right. It's probably more important than ever. Yeah.
From their parents.
Quite. Yeah. Rebecca, I'm going to have to cut you off there. You're making a very good point, but I've completely run out of time. So I appreciate that. And I'll give you the last word on that topic. Coming up after the news, Prince William has criticised big business for what he calls falling short and lacking courage in their attempts to tackle climate change. The Prince of Wales has spent 5 days last week in Brazil for his Earthshot Prize Awards and the COP30 Climate Conference. He's calling on the business community to step up to the plate and criticise the way that many businesses were still reluctant to get involved. Do you agree with Prince William that businesses should do more to fight climate change? And what do you think needs to change? And what do you personally do to tackle climate change? Are you an ethical consumer? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the leader of the Liberal Democrats says it's time for the BBC to turn a new leaf after the resignation of its Director General. The corporation's chief executive of news has also announced she's stepping down. It's expected the BBC will issue an apology later on today over the way a speech by President Trump was edited for an edition of Panorama. The Lib Dems spokesperson for culture, Anna Sabine, has been talking to Nick Abbott on LBC. She says the corporation must be held to account and protected at times.
I think it's a difficult situation the BBC now finds itself in. I think we've always said the BBC isn't perfect, as a party, the Lib Dems have definitely had our problems with them, but we feel it's a very important institution in our country. It's important for holding up British values, and I think we're seeing this evening by some of the reactions this news is getting from people like Trump and Farage that is a good reason why we need to defend it in an age of misinformation.
The Culture Secretary has been thanking Tim Davey for his work in public service broadcasting. Lisa Nandy's made the comments after talking to LBC on Sunday morning about the BBC's recent record. Our political editor Natasha Clark says the resignations may have surprised her.
The culture secretary was speaking to LBC defending him, saying that, you know, he's been a good director general and, you know, she's not happy with some of the processes that the BBC has at the moment, but, you know, refusing to say that she had any sort of shakiness or any sort of hint that he was about to go.
Police are searching for an alleged supporter of Palestine Action who's failed to return to prison. LBC understands he's a 32-year-old called Sean Middleborough. He was temporarily freed from HMP Wandsworth for his brother's wedding. The Crime and Justice reporter David Shipley's been talking to LBC.
Each individual
early release or accidental release has its own particular reasons. In some cases, the prison's got it wrong. In some cases, the court sent the wrong paperwork, we learned in one case last week. In this scenario, it seems that the court has decided to grant bail to someone who they trusted would return.
The co-op says it's pushing forward with a major investment programme as it continues recovering from a damaging cyber attack. It's expected the retailer will open or reopen 50 branches by Christmas. And in sport, Steve Tandy's first game as the Welsh Rugby Union head coach has ended in a record defeat against Argentina. They were beaten 52-28 in Cardiff. LBC weather, rain, which could be heavy at times, will move north from the southwest as the night goes on. Clear skies will follow behind it. We'll see a low of around 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Prince of Wales has criticised big businesses for what he calls falling short and lacking courage in their attempts to tackle climate change. Prince William spent 5 days last week in Brazil for his Earthshot Prize Awards and the COP30 Climate Conference. He is apparently deeply frustrated by the private sector's apathy on the environment. Let's talk about this with Fergal McEntee. Fergal is an environmental campaigner and renewable energy professional. Hello, Fergal.
Hi, Nick. Hi, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for doing this. Do you think he's wishing on a dream, Prince William? Companies will only really do something if they think it's going to bring more money to their shareholders and executives. Well, they're caring for the planet. It's not even a consideration, is it?
Yeah, well, I think you've just summed it up just there. Like, business is in business to make money and to, you know, for the fiscal responsibility of the shareholders. However, now with environmental reporting, there's more emphasis on ESG governance for companies of, you know, reporting of what they do to protect the planet, what the, you know, how much greenhouse gas they use.
Can I just stop you? ESG?
So environmental social governance. Right. So it's a reporting framework that's in place, which is also failing. It's a corporate responsibility. And so what we've got is we've got big businesses. They're very reluctant to put in any form of structural change that's going to affect essentially the bottom line. And having another regulation in place, having to like report about the environment is more of a hindrance when it comes to the bottom line.
Right. So you think that part of the push to mitigate the effects of climate change is not really working?
Yeah. So, like, if you want to kind of think about like the bigger picture, like we need to be investing like not billions but trillions. We need to be, like, it's like 5 to 7 trillion per year. If it, like, theoretically, if we want to tackle like the ecological and climate emergency, and we're nowhere near, you know, any of those figures right now. And the only way of doing it is actually, you know, we have to change the laws, you know, and actually make it like responsibility of everybody. Private corporations and citizens and everybody to actually work towards these goals. So I think the message that the Prince is saying is right, you know, but it's kind of unless there's actually laws put in place to make them do it, it's not going to happen. It's not happening.
Or if the public decide that they will reward companies that do actually make a positive difference.
Yeah, well, that's it. We need to have like a complete change. We need to. I think there's a lot of rhetoric going on at the moment about net zero, and it's the wrong way of framing it. We've just had now the Potsdam Institute. They came out last month with their 2025 planetary health check, and they measure 9 planetary boundaries. And it's not just climate change; it's the health of the soils, the oceans, the reports. Highlighted now we've actually crossed 7 of the planetary boundaries. So without having sustainable soil and oceans and air to breathe, we're not going to have the kind of livable planet very soon for like our kids and the grandchildren that we expect. So the message is correct.
Is there any evidence, though, to show that if companies do the right thing by the environment, the customers will actually reward them?
I think there is a growing movement of people making like choices of like, you know, what they buy and the reason they you know the goods and services that they want, but it has to be a carrot and stick approach. You need to have the laws in place, and then also you need to have the right messages getting out there and like telling people, you know, what they should be buying and what they should be consuming or not consuming. So it's a pretty much a mixed approach.
We're not really ethically minded people, though. We like to think that we are, but we aren't. And I'm reminded of a poll that just recently came out about the funds needed to improve the NHS, and they asked people, you know, how much would they be prepared to pay, if anything, to you know, secure the future of the NHS? And those earning over 60,000 a year. One third of them said, yes, I am prepared to pay more tax, but only £10 more a year. So if we're not really prepared to stump up for that, then we're really not going to be prepared to stump up for, you know, cleaner air and water and land.
Yeah, well, we'll put it this way. The government can find money, governments around the world can find money to increase the amount of money they spend on military. And if we had a fraction of the money that's been spent on military over the years, that's enough to actually tackle not just the climate, but also to clean up the planet. So the focus is in the wrong place.
Yes, but do you think that the government is only focusing in the wrong place because we, the public, the voters, have really shown... it's almost the opposite of what we're saying we're concerned with. We're really shown by our actions as consumers that we just don't care.
I think, unfortunately, I think a lot of people, like, they don't have the information to care. And, you know, we've got a cost of living crisis, and it's another thing to kind of to worry about. So that's why we need bold leadership by governments, you know, to really take the lead on this and to actually highlight the state of the planet, and as they did in the recent planetary health check report, and, you know, look at the bigger picture. And we need to be promoting, you know, a rollout of insulation across the whole of the UK to 19 million properties. We need to be, you know, switching from gas and other fossil fuels to renewables. And all these things can be put in place by government and through legislation. And the thing is, like, the more money that you invest in the green economy, you actually get more out of it than traditional industries. So if you're putting more money into renewables, you get more money comes back into local economies than investing in like, a, you know, a new oil well, which is going to be, like, depleted, like, 20, 30 years. So the focus is in the wrong place. It's short-termism that we've got going on, and it's too much influence, too much power by big businesses, you know, and the fossil fuel companies still... You know, they dictate to the governments of, you know, what policies to put in place.
Yes, I mean, they're the ones with the biggest megaphone because they've got the most money. We're really sort of it's an uphill battle for the green industries to get heard at all, despite the obvious fact that you just outlined it. You know, oil is a depleting resource. I mean, oil, coal, fossil fuels in general are not the future because there's only a limited amount of them. Surely the future, the most obvious thing to go for, that's where the future jobs must be, is renewable, endless energy, free at the source. We just have to, you know, improve our ways of collecting it, solar power and wind power and so on. And yet, the green energy industries, they don't have the kind of lobbying muscle that the fossil fuel industries do, this sort of dying, thrashing business that is determined to extract as much money as they possibly can before the curtains are closed on that industry. And that's sort of where we are now, at a crossroads, isn't it? And we do seem to be taking the wrong path.
Yeah, we are at a crossroads, and they're... Oil and gas companies will keep on producing oil and gas as long as they can sell every barrel of oil that they actually produce. And the only way of tackling that is through, again, it's through clever taxation, and it's also from giving the right incentives to the renewable industry to take heed, putting in, like, in the UK, we need to put in, like, a vast amount of infrastructure, you know, upgrading the national grid. And by doing that, we will create, like, hundreds of thousands and millions of green jobs of going through this transition. And once we do, we can stop importing fossil fuels. We spend £1 billion a day importing fossil fuels, and we just burn it, right? And the markets go up and down, and we're very heavily reliant on what's happening in the global space. And if we can like use all the resources of the North Sea with wind, invest in battery technology, invest in more solar, invest in our homes, you know, also like the transportation system, you know, sustainable rail, we'll go like a very far way towards that, and we'll actually be making the country safer, greener, better air, and more money coming into the economy. So it's a win-win-win.
And you mentioned that you know, part of it is about education, but surely the public know all this instinctively. They know that, you know, coal makes air dirty and petrol engines are less clean than electric ones. I mean, they have a real world experience of that. And yet, we don't really. It's as though the human race is sort of hardwired into continuing to do what it has done, rather than dip its toe into what is, you know, relatively unknown.
It's, you know, well, I'm part of this is going to be the media as well. So LBC, you guys are pretty good, but you got the likes of Reform, and they're just like putting out this propaganda that net zero is unaffordable. And it's the way that they frame it. It's like it's you're debating against physics. You know, net zero is to stop increasing global temperatures of the world so we can have a livable planet. And we've got a roadmap to actually do that. And the roadmap will actually create the jobs and create the industries and create homegrown jobs as well. You know, by doubling down on fossil fuels, we're not going to get anywhere. You know, so I think we really need to look at like the misinformation and disinformation that's getting branded about.
Well, the Earthshot Prize is one of William's pet projects. It's a global environmental prize awarded to 5 winners each year for their contribution towards environmentalism. So that is a positive step forward. Are there any other things that we can take comfort from that have happened lately as far as industry's relationship and actions toward the environment are concerned?
If you want to take some like positives, like in terms of like let's say like renewable energy, my industry, we're now able to make renewable energy a fraction of the cost of new coal and gas, and also like 2 or 3 times cheaper than new nuclear. And the speed of deployment, it takes like 10, 15 years to build a nuclear power plant, and we can build a solar farm in 11 months. So we've got like the technology is advancing. We're using different chemicals for batteries, so we're not reliant on any one country. It's actually the speed that we're actually going through transformation. If we continue like supporting it, means we can actually like decarbonize our grid in you know, next like maybe 7-8 years. So we're UK has done like a lot of great work. But there's certain industries like aviation, you know, that we just have to get rid of, like cheap flights, and you know, take a long, hard look at some of the, you know, some of the industries that are like hard to abate, you know, and not to criticise too much, like Prince William, but like Earthshot Prize, it's great for highlighting the plight of the planet, and you know, for like trying to encourage people to, you know, to look at the different businesses and things that they can do to help the economy and the environment and everything. So it's good, and I think Prince William does a very good job of promoting it. But it'd be good, I think, if the royal family actually just cleaned up a little bit of their own households, like the amounts of emissions that they have from, you know, high carbon travel is like, it's unbelievable. I think it's like it's about 6,000 tons a year, which, to put it into perspective, is the average UK person is about 10 tons. So you're talking about, yeah, you know, so...
So maybe he's not the right person to be... I get he could just spend his life playing polo, I suppose, so this is a positive. But it is a bit rich from a man whose family live in multiple palaces, houses, castles, cottages, lodges, parks, halls and manors, and take motorcades, helicopters and private trains between them.
Yeah, it's a little bit hypocritical, you know. So at least, though, the positive is like, at least they're using their platform, and they do have a global platform, and they're very well received of actually giving that message. But I think, you know, it's kind of a case of like, you know, it starts off with yourself, your community, people around you, your businesses, your country. So we need to like tackle it like for like all different levels. And I think the royal family could, like, you know, it could look at the, I think it's got like 800,000 acres of royal estates across the UK, which a lot of it's just used for like deer and gorse for like for hunting, which has a very negative effect on the planet. And we would use vast swathes of that for actually rewilding and, you know, even giving back to, you know, some new public parks or, you know, if we need some more green spaces.
Lots more work to be done all round. Good to talk to you, Fergal. Thanks very much for that. Fergal McEntee, environmental campaigner and renewable energy professional. So what do you make of Prince William's actions on this, criticising big business for falling short? A lot of businesses do position themselves as being environmentally aware. Do you think they're actually serious about it, or are they greenwashing their reputation? And what about you? Have you changed your spending to address environmental concerns? Are you an ethical consumer? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Hi, babe. Yeah, mad day. So, do you fancy staying in tonight instead? Delivery fee is now from 99p on the Mackey's app, and we can get a free chicken Big Mac if we spend £15. So, you in? Of course you are.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. £15 spend only on main day food and drink via delivery until the 19th of October. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
Aldi's Super 6 fresh fruit and veg from just 69p. Saving you up to a whopping 30%. British baby potatoes, large red onions and royal gala apples. Plus pomegranate, cauliflower and large flat mushrooms. In store today. Aldi. Multiple fruit and veg retailer 2025 at the FPC Fresh Awards. Products and prices may vary, subject to availability.
Our pets in a pickle. We know your furry friends get up to all kinds of mischief. That's why we're here when it matters most. With fuss-free pet insurance policies, including unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We are talking about the Prince of Wales. He has criticised big business for falling short and, in his words, lacking courage in their attempts to tackle climate change. Maybe it's not the courage they lack, maybe it's the interest. Maybe they just don't care. And the only way that they will be made to care, perhaps, is if we, the consumers, force them to do that by the choices that we make at their tills. Have you changed the way you shop in order to address what you see as concerns for the climate? 0345 6060 973 Surbiton, Fawaz.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I was just listening in to the previous caller, and I think, I disagree with the gentleman. I believe that UK has actually done a very poor job of managing its geological endowment up in the north with the oil and gas assets that we currently have.
Well, it's, compared with Norway, certainly.
Exactly. I mean, Norway has put an 80% reimbursement on any capex put back into the well, and they have managed to maintain the production at a much higher level. And so everyone who puts a dollar in, 80 cents on that gets reimbursed by the Norwegian government. And when the oil comes out, they take 80 cents back from the money sold on the barrels.
Yeah, typical Britain. We gave it all away, just like we did our water and our electricity and our gas and you name it, it's gone.
And that whole industry had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs up in Aberdeen and in Scotland, and we've just done a very poor job of it and replaced it with more expensive energy, which puts our industrial industry makes it uncompetitive.
Which is the more expensive energy?
Like, basically, the entire renewable energy is more expensive than the oil and gas that you can produce locally. So
in what sense more expensive?
It's got the levelized cost of energy. So on an energy equivalent basis, it's basically wind and they actually said that the offshore wind farms basically were like 75 cents per kilowatt hour. It's much more expensive and cost of production. And hence we actually import gas because it's cheaper. And now the new offshore wind farms, they're moving the PPAs, the 20-year PPAs price up because the previous subsidies that were becoming too onerous and expensive. The energy is just too expensive.
If you want to talk about subsidies, the UK government currently provides almost £18,000 million a year in fossil fuel subsidies.
You mean over, like, the winter heating fuel, et cetera, or...
Well, it's direct subsidies for fossil fuel industry producers and subsidies for the consumers of the energy, the public. And over the current lifetime of this government, it's going to total the taxpayers' subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, £87.5 billion. Which is something that is never mentioned by people such as yourself, who decry the advancement of renewable energy. I mean, isn't that the key of it? Renewable. The costs aren't limited to the extraction of the oil. The costs include, surely, the damage that that extraction causes to the planet, both locally and worldwide.
So there is an element of global leadership. When you say global damage, there's obviously the curse of the commons involved. If we talk about local problems, affordability, making UK manufacturing competitive, making UK grow, making us grow, we need to get the cheapest energy possible. So yes, you could say that we have a moral imperative to show leadership, but we are making ourselves poorer and uncompetitive if we don't go for the cheapest source of energy possible, both for households and for our manufacturing footprint.
Yeah, but it's not the cheapest, though. It's the most expensive as far as the extra costs that are involved in cleaning up after the business. I mean, wind doesn't pollute anything.
Wind has, as it turned out, the maintenance costs are higher than people think. The bird migratory patterns are also causing a problem. And there's something called...
Really? The oil industry is interested in birds? Come on.
No, the wind. What happens is the bird strikes are causing... the wind farms
I understand that, but it seems a bit... And to be clear, you're calling as an investor in fossil fuel industries, right?
No, I'm an investor in renewable industries as well. In fact, those investments have been quite poor. As you probably know, a lot of those industries have struggled. Some of the renewable giants in Europe, Ørsted and others, have actually suffered. So, no, I'm an investor in both industries. The problem is that I'm currently calling from the perspective of just making us competitive, and we need to just grow with the debt burden that we have, and we need to get the cheapest source of energy possible.
You keep saying that, but you're denying that that fossil fuels actually cause more costs in cleaning up and the consequences of their use than renewable systems of providing energy. You seem to be ignoring that cost entirely.
No, I'm not ignoring. I'm saying if we had managed those assets better, there will be less shutdowns and end-of-life field requirements. If instead of in 2022, when energy prices spiked, they went for a super tax, Mr. Sunak's government, instead of actually saying, we want to get manage our geological endowment better, we should instill more investment back into these fields. So instead of shutting them down and having end of mine or end of well cost cleanup, we could actually maintain and minimize the production declines. So we will have less cost effectively from that.
Yeah, again, I mean, I keep making the same point, but you keep ignoring it. You keep just concentrating on I would debate that, or I would question that the oil is cheaper than wind or solar. I very much doubt that it is. But you are ignoring the cost that comes with using oil that is absent with using renewable energy.
Okay, so, well, oil is mostly used for transportation. Basically, obviously, the petchem industry also uses it for some products. But for generally in gas for heating and et cetera and industrial uses, it is clearly at the moment to electrify the entire transport infrastructure, which is what you would say would be replacing oil. So that is not even possible for heavy trucks because the batteries are too high. Then you need hydrogen solutions for that, because otherwise the truck comes too heavy with batteries.
Yes, but it's not an either or, is it? We don't have to do it all at the same time. We're moving towards a better system. What you and people like you seem to want is that we continue with this with this polluting, dirty system that we have been using for the last 100 years. Let's move forward.
Well, recently the recent forecast is that the 1.5 degree is not even achievable. I think that.
Well, let's just forget about it then. I mean, come on, you have to be serious. Otherwise, I just can't take you. If you're not serious, I can't take you seriously. That was Fawaz, who says he's a hedge fund manager who invests in fossil fuel companies. The oil and gas industry needs some love, is what he told the phone operator before he was put through to me. I think they've got plenty of love. I think they've had no end of love. 87.5 billion pounds in fossil fuel subsidies over the course of this parliament, in this country alone. 87.5 billion. Andrew in Stroud Green says the royals should, at the very least, remove their royal warrants from businesses that do not have green credentials. Andrew says the great idea, get rid of cheap flights, make driving petrol and diesel cars in London very expensive, and increase the cost of beef from cows, that fart, welcome to the world for the rich only. Well, it isn't the rich only. These are all nudges to persuade us to live a better life for the benefit of ourselves and particularly the following generations. Judy in Connecticut says, I know it's not your thing, but a plant-based diet has a massive impact on the climate. I'm vegan, and I love that how I eat is helping in my own way. Well, there's something to be said for that, for sure. We're going to take a break for the news, more of your calls on this, but we're going to take a switch after the news because an independent review has been launched by the government as nearly a million people are not working or studying. We'll speak to a youth worker after the news, and later on we'll catch up with what's been going on in America. But first, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey, is saying it's time for the BBC to turn a new leaf after the resignation of its Director General. The corporation's chief executive of news has also stepped down. At least two deaths have been reported in the Philippines following the arrival of a super typhoon. The storm, named Feng Wong, has brought wind speeds of around 140 miles per hour to the region. And the co-op says it's pushing forward with a major investment program while it recovers from a damaging cyber attack. It's expected the retailer will open or reopen 50 branches by Christmas. LBC weather, rain which could be heavy at times moving north from the southwest as the night goes on. Clear skies behind it with a low of around 8 degrees.
The new LBC app. News your way. This is LBC.
Angela Rippon, what are you doing here?
I've come to tell you about using energy flexibly, Albert.
Flexibly?
Yes, smart meter owners could get rewarded for moving their energy use, like doing the laundry at off-peak times.
So I don't need to do the splits?
No, Albert, nobody wants to see that.
Get rewarded for using energy flexibly, only with a smart meter. Search Get a Smart Meter today.
Eligibility and availability vary. Consumer action required. Reward schemes and tariffs available to selected customers from selected suppliers.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard your flight to Geneva. This is your captain speaking, and I would like to take a second to welcome our very special guests. All the skis and snowboards that enjoy a free flight to Winter Wonderland.
The best winter holidays start with the right airline. Book your family trip to Winter Wonderland now on Swiss.com and enjoy free gear transport.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
The Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, Pat McFadden, has called the high figure of 16 to 24-year-olds falling out of education or work a crisis of opportunity. One in eight young people currently fall into that NEET, N-E-E-T, category. The total figure now approaching a million. Let's talk about this with Paul Oginski. Paul is a former youth policy advisor to several governments and now CEO of Vibe, a youth organisation dedicated to supporting young people. He's also author of The Best of Us, Life Lessons from Youth Work. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Nick.
So what's behind this trend, do you think, for 16 to 24-year-olds falling out of education and work?
Right, Nick, I think if we see the jobs market as like any market, there's a supply and demand problem, I think. So if we look at the young people, the supply of young people, have we got a million young people who aren't engaging because they lack self-belief, they lack ambition, they lack the ability to work academically and socially? And then we've got to look at the other side of that, the demand side. It's like, are employers looking for these young people, but they don't quite know how to get to them and reach them? Is employing a young person simple? Is it low risk? Is it beneficial? So I think we need to look at the supply and the demand side. And I would say a lot of young people now are lacking self-belief, are lacking ambition, they are lacking the ability to work, the work ethic, and the social acumen to be in the workplace.
So what differentiates this 16 to 24-year-old group from previous ones then?
Well, I mean, this isn't unique. You know, for a long time we have had youth unemployment quite high, but I think it's got worse because how do you build them skills, that self-belief, that self-awareness, that self-respect, that gets you that ambition? You build that by mixing with other people, and especially with adults effectively. What's happened over the last, since the pandemic, obviously there was a big impact on young people mixing with other people. But also we've closed all the youth clubs, we've closed, we haven't got youth workers now, and the school is much more focused on academic ability and the ability to read and write, which is absolutely important. But also equally important is the ability to mix with other people. Especially adults. I mean, if you're going into the workplace, you've got to be able to mix and with confidence and communicate with adults. Unfortunately, a lot of the young people now that we're working with, they don't see them, so they don't have that sense of belonging. They don't see them opportunities out there for themselves, so they lose a lot of ambition, and that's really sad.
Yeah, apart from the COVID bit, though, then I don't really know what the difference is between what young people are like now to how they were, a few decades ago. Okay, COVID treated young people particularly badly, but it was for a limited period, and it seems a bit much to blame a few lockdowns and some missed school for just kind of dropping out of life.
Yeah, it's a fair comment. I mean, it did have a bigger impact than any of us expected, I think. But also, young people now, they don't tend to get out of their bedrooms as much. They tend to... You can do everything you want in your bedroom, can't you? You can shop online, you can socialise through a computer screen. What we need to do is get them out of their bedrooms, get them mixing with other young people, building healthy relationships, and especially getting them mixing with adults.
Yeah, and... on the subject of phones and, artificial intelligence in general, is there a sense of hopelessness at the prospect that AI is going to render many skills and knowledge bases irrelevant?
Are you asking me if for me or for young people?
Yeah, young people.
I think young people now are more comfortable with AI and with computers than our generation is. But I think they need to see where their place is in the workplace. If you interview, like we do, some of these young people, we say, where do you see yourself? Where do you see your future? A lot of them are very low or limited or no ambition about being in the workplace. I mean, I was talking to some... a group of young lads and a group of young girls, and I said to them, what's your ambition? And the lads said, I'd like to work in a warehouse, which I don't think is very ambitious. And a lot of the girls said, I'd like to be a wag. You know, it's like, so it's like that, you know, it's seeing yourself and your place in society as being associated with somebody else.
Yeah.
It's sad, isn't it, really? You know, we need to get them ambitions up and get them to see a job for themselves out there that they're aspiring to. You know?
Well, yeah, but haven't kids always wanted to be something like that? They've always wanted to be, you know, a footballer or a rock star or something like that, which is only available to a very, very small number of people. But just because they couldn't become that, kids in the past didn't say, right, well, that's it, I'm just going to sit at home and do nothing, because that option wasn't really available to them. So is it that society is treating too... I don't know what the word is, kindly, or we are sort of kowtowing to their needs too much, rather than saying, right, well, you know, you're not going to be Jimi Hendrix or whatever the current equivalent is, so get out there and get a job.
Well, I think that's always been said to everyone who wants to be the next Jimi Hendrix, that, hasn't it? But you've got to have a fallback position. And when with the young people, we say, okay, that's fine. You know, you want to be an astronaut, you want to be a footballer, you want to be a rock star, whatever. Okay, go for it. But have a fallback position. What if that doesn't work? What would you rather do? What I'm saying to you, Nick, is they don't even have that first ambition quite often now. You know, it's like to be a wag isn't the same as to be a footballer, even a female footballer, isn't it? You know, to work in a warehouse isn't the same ambition as to be a rock star or something. It's like, come on, get your heads up, get out there. You could be anything you want to be. And having that fallback position, aim for the stars. If you hit the roof, that's okay. I would like young people to be going to schools and them schools saying, you're amazing at something and it's our job to find out what that is and help you to get there. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be that we're asking young people to jump through so many hoops that meet our needs, really, and our Ofsted reports. And let's get on to young people to get them to be ambitious, to get them to realise how much potential they have. And then get that energy up again. You know, they seem to be losing a lot of that energy, which is really sad. Sad for them and sad for the country.
Yeah, among the alarming stats that come out of this issue is that those 16 to 24-year-olds claiming health and disability benefits rose 50% in the past 5 years. Now, you could say that COVID had some lingering effect on a lot of people, but that's a heck of a stat, isn't it? So are we just accepting young people's self-diagnosis of, for instance, mental health problems that excuse them from working too readily?
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to diminish that as if a young person presents with mental health problems, then we need to take that seriously. But if you listen to, like, people who are experts in mental health, people like Mind, and that, they often say that these problems start from relationship breakdown somewhere where people feel isolated, they don't feel like they can communicate, and they withdraw from society, withdraw into the room. And I think there'll be parents listening to us talk now who will recognise this and they worry about their young people. It's like we've got to encourage them to get out, mix and socialise. Unfortunately, that, you know, the earlier you can start that, the better. And unfortunately, we've closed all the youth clubs, we've got rid of all the youth workers, there's less places, especially if you haven't got money, there's less places to go and mix, and we need to bring that back, and we need to do a lot more personal and social development with young people so that they feel ambitious and they can see a place for themselves in society.
You know, I've heard many times people ring in, and you know, when this kind of topic comes up, and they'll say, you know, I work in a business and I employed or tried to employ a teenager, and they called in on their first day and said that they were a bit tired that day and they'd gone out caning it the previous night, so can they come in tomorrow? And just the whole attitude to work is completely alien to older people. So is this sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that if young people find it difficult to fit in and actually do a good day's work, then employers will be reluctant to hire them, and that just makes the problem, you know, progressively worse and worse and worse?
Well, I've run a business, and at the moment I run a charity, and yeah, you've got to de-risk that for the business and the charity. You've got to say, okay, look, they have a really good system in Germany where the government takes a lot of the initial risk on of employing a young person. Our apprenticeship scheme, the apprentice levy, that doesn't seem to be working for a lot of young people, a lot of businesses. It's quite bureaucratic, it's quite high risk, and employers are not really seeing the benefits. So we've got to simplify that. And we've got to remember, going into the workplace for a young person is an alien experience. You know, they don't know the norms of the work ethic. And I heard a story recently about a young person who actually got a placement, and they said, okay, you start on Tuesday. So he started on Tuesday, and the following week it was a bank holiday. So everyone was off, so they came in the following Tuesday. So the next week, he didn't come in on the Monday. He just thought, we always start on a Tuesday, you know?
Right.
It was like, because they just don't know. You've got to accept that this, we're used to it, and, you know, we're used to picking up a phone and speaking to strangers and, you know, going into reception areas and that, but I work with young people who seem really, really confident, but when you say to them, yeah, I phone someone they don't know, they just look at you with total terror. So we've got to remember what it's like to be a 16-year-old and support that.
You mentioned that schools are concentrated on academic ability. Do you think that they should actually be more aware to the possibilities of getting on in life with physical skills?
100%. From your mouth to Keir Starmer's ear, please, because we want schools. And teaching is a particular profession, but I think if you're looking at personal social development, the expertise is with youth workers in that area. And it's like, what we need is to give equal weight into academic and personal social development so that we get more rounded young people coming out of schools. It's woeful at the moment. It's like, you know, it's like, if you're not, if I say to young people, what makes a successful person? Even if I was saying to you or your listeners, like, what makes a successful person? The first words that come out is someone who can mix with people, who's confident, who's got self-esteem and all them kind of things. And, of course, then money comes into it and whether you've got power and all that kind of stuff. But it's equally as important as academic, and yet we just don't seem to be able to do it properly in this country.
You know, we mentioned phones and AI and so on, and it seems to my eyes that we've got a generation now who are completely addicted, as though it was a hard drug, to their phones. Do you think that this government actually takes seriously enough that situation? Because it seems as though it's hobbling the entire generation. You've talked about their inability to talk to people, particularly on their phone. They use their phone all right, but they never use it to. They don't communicate with their mouth. They communicate with their thumbs, which is not a really. It's not a skill that is very transferable to the jobs market. Do you think that actually the nature of the things that they are addicted to, they're gawping at all day long, is actually ruinous to their physical health and their mental health and their ability to socialise and actually take part in society?
Yes, it's absolutely ruinous for them. We need that human interaction, but I would say it's not just young people. You see it with adults now. You probably see it with members of your family. It's like you invite people around and they're on the phone looking at it. It's like, this is kind of like a newish thing in society, but we need to actually interact with other humans purposefully. One thing I would say was interesting is the guy who won the Nobel Prize for economics this year said that going forward, AI is going to be able to do virtually every job. But what AI won't be able to do is the personal interaction jobs that we do at the moment. And I would say, again, of course, youth work. But it's like, you know, that where you need to speak to another human, whatever AI gets to do in the future, that is going to be crucial and something that AI can't replicate. So that's where we need to be directing young people in schools to work as a team, to be leaders, to enjoy other people's company and not be frightened and running off to the bedroom, because obviously a lot of bullying happens on social media as well.
Yeah, also AI won't be able to come over and fix your leaking tap or to or to wire in a socket.
No, maybe one of Elon Musk's robots can when he gets done. But no, even using fixing a leaking tap or being a plumber, which is what you're leaning on, electric. And if you speak to plumbers and electricians or basically anyone, they're effective if they're effective with other people and how they interact with people. It's, you know, if you get a narky plumber who just fixes your tap and goes off, you're not going to call them back, are you?
Good to talk to you, Paul. Thanks very much for that.
Good to talk to you, Nick. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Paul Oginski, former youth policy advisor to several governments, now CEO of Vibe, a youth organisation dedicated to supporting young people, and author of The Best of Us, Life Lessons from Youth Work. Now, a short break, and then off to America to talk to Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Jim Diamond.
At 2, Prince William set to join forces with Gordon Brown to help prevent homelessness. But first, Tim Davies quit the BBC. Is the future of the corporation now in doubt?
Jim Diamond at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day?
Ferroglobin is a great-tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of hemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics at Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com.
The greatest rivalry in British boxing reignites November 15th on DAZN. Eubank Jr. versus Ben 2. The first fight was all out war. 12 brutal rounds born of bad blood, but there's still unfinished business. Eubank's out to end it for good. Ben comes for revenge. Don't miss Eubank Jr. versus Ben 2, Saturday, November 15th. Download the DAZN app and watch on any device, including Sky, Amazon Prime Video and Virgin Media. Buy now at DAZN.com.
Are you a London black cab driver thinking of ways to boost your earnings during those quieter times? Why not consider Uber? We can give your meter a wake-up call. Join close to 1,000 black cab drivers already on Uber. Black cabs on Uber are priced by your meter, and the service fee will be no more than 5% until the end of 2025. Turn downtime into prime time. Go to uber.com/black cabs to start earning today. Terms and conditions apply.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well, you're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
Simon Marks is LBC's Washington correspondent and joins us on the line now. Hello, Simon.
Good evening, Nick.
How are you?
I'm all right, mate. How are you?
Very well. Disappointed to see that Trump and his weird spokesmodel are doing a victory lap, having brought down the head of the BBC.
They definitely are doing a victory lap. President Trump on Air Force One today, taking to social media as he learnt of the decision by Tim Davie and Deborah Turness to resign. Did they resign? Were they pushed? 50-50 on that one. But the White House absolutely delighted because, of course, they had seized on these claims regarding the Panorama documentary about President Trump and the January the 6th uprising on Capitol Hill and the way in which President Trump's soundbites were edited together to make it look as though he said to them, we're going to march up to Capitol Hill and you are going to fight like hell, even though those two parts of the speech are very much separated by several minutes, if you go back to the transcript of the original event. But, you know, there's no doubt that on January the 6th, President Trump did urge his supporters initially to protest peacefully on Capitol Hill, but then amped them up later in the speech and said, if you don't fight like hell, we're not going to have a country anymore. Nonetheless, that edit, I think most people that I've spoken to who, like me, work in the TV industry, think at the very least was clumsy on the part of Panorama. And it's certainly extraordinary that the BBC has kind of twisted in the wind for the last several days until today. It appears to have taken government intervention to force the ouster of Tim Davie and Deborah Turness, the Director General and Head of News, respectively. For the White House, this is a big win. We heard from President Trump last week that he considers the BBC to be 100% fake news. That is exactly what his press secretary, Caroline Levitt, said. She said that one of the worst experiences she has in her life is when she travels to the UK and she is forced to watch BBC News in her hotel room, presumably because the staff have hidden the remote somewhere so she can't change the channel, or she doesn't know how to change the channel. But look, I think this speaks to a bigger shift that is taking place, not just in terms of the White House press corps, but in terms of the British press corps in Washington. I mean, it's been pretty clear for the last few weeks that the plan ultimately on the part of Caroline Levitt is to take that BBC seat in the White House briefing room, which I believe they share with Newsweek magazine. It's like a fractionally owned seat in the briefing room. It seems pretty clear to me they're going to take that away from the BBC and hand it over to GB News, which is very much now their favorite channel in town, and it allows them to dispatch the BBC to the quote-unquote legacy media hinterlands of the White House briefing room. You know, Auntie's reporters, along with the rest of us, will be stuck at the back shouting questions at Caroline Levitt and trying to get her attention, while it's perfectly possible that GB News finds itself with a pretty decent seat in that briefing room, because they are now, of course, Donald Trump's favourite British TV channel.
And it's not the only media organisation that Trump has attacked, and all of whom have capitulated under his attack for the benefit of their shareholders, and they include Paramount, the parent company of CBS, Google, YouTube, Meta and Twitter, and
ABC.
Disney. Disney, the parent company of ABC, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the pattern that we're witnessing is absolutely clear. And it is, by the way, one of the reasons why more and more people, certainly in this town, I mean, I can tell you this from personal experience, are turning to alternative sources for news. And one of those sources is this very radio station. I mean, we now know from the fact that people very occasionally come up and recognize me in Washington, D.C., and they're Americans, but we also know it from the data that we see, particularly with regard to LBC's YouTube channel, that, you know, around a third of the audience is now coming from the United States. And that's because I think there is an audience here in the US that is increasingly disillusioned with media entities here that have bent the knee before Donald Trump. And look, I mean, he hasn't really so far succeeded in the takeover of ABC News, but I think that's absolutely next on his to-do list. CBS, to all intents and purposes, now is captive to people that are relatively loyal to President Trump and to his agenda. The Washington Post, captive to Jeff Bezos's decision to bend the knee to Donald Trump. This is a trend, and we're only at the end of the first year, not even at the end of the first year of his presidency. We've got three more to go.
Right, let's talk about the shutdown. Apparently, Donald Trump has ordered U.S. states to stop paying full food aid to low-income families, and the number of them are relying on what they called SNAP payments. Of 42 million people. He's using starvation as a weapon?
Well, he has been, and there is every indication tonight, Nick, that it has worked. Because the latest news from Capitol Hill is that this government shutdown may be clattering to its conclusion, and may be doing so because centrist Democrats on Capitol Hill are capitulating to the Republicans. The Senate has been in session all weekend, and tonight Republicans believe that they have peeled enough Democrats away from the party's leadership to get a stopgap funding measure passed through the Senate in a vote later tonight that could see the government reopen in several days' time. The reason why it's going to take so long is because speeding up the process of reopening the government and getting all of this tied up with a ribbon would require consent from all 100 senators, and there's no way the Republicans are going to get that. So it's going to be a slow series of votes that gets this through. Then the entire House of Representatives, which has already passed a stopgap funding measure, would need to come back to Washington, D.C., and pass the new version of the agreement that the Senate is drawing up. Early reports, and I will caution that these are early reports, suggest that the Democrats have not got very much out of this deal. They appear to have secured a promise from the Republicans that there will be a vote on extending subsidies to help millions of Americans pay for Obamacare next month. That's going to enrage the left of the party, which presumes correctly that the Democrats will lose that vote, and doesn't believe that any negotiation that involves a compromise on Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is tolerable. They also appear to have extracted a concession that all of the federal government workers that were laid off, not just furloughed, but fired during the course of this shutdown, will be rehired. And that is a compromise by the White House, but frankly, not much of one. So at this point, if this vote goes through, if they've peeled away the eight Democrats that they need to bring it across the finishing line later tonight or in the early hours of tomorrow, it would suggest that the stage will be set for the government to reopen, but the stage will also be set for a bruising internal fight among Democrats over why centrists in the Senate have capitulated to the White House and agreed to this series of proposals from the Republicans. And that's because they're feeling the heat, and they're feeling the heat from constituents in many parts of the country who literally don't know where their next meal is going to come from because these food assistance payments have been held up. And also, of course, because they're feeling the heat from the traveling public at the end of a weekend in which collectively, I think nearly 4,000 flights were cancelled all over the country because the air traffic controllers aren't showing up for work. What a way to run a country.
Yeah, it's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah, Simon,
you do it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for that. Mate. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order that you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a boatload of podcasts, in amongst which you will find mine. Download all the new, all new LBC app for free from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ian Payne. But first, Jim Diamond.
Thank you very much indeed. Coming up...
I don't think homelessness has to be an inevitability. And when you look at examples like Finland, they were able to reduce it significantly in a really short period of time.
Prince William and Gordon Brown have joined forces in order to prevent homelessness. At 2, I'll be asking, what do we need to do to solve this ever-present problem? But first...
I do have confidence in both Samir Shah and Tim Davey that they're treating this with the utmost seriousness.
Well, despite Lisa Nandy's confidence, Tim Davey has now resigned as Director General of the BBC after the editing of audio from Donald Trump in the show Panorama. What is the future for the BBC now, and have they ruined their reputation? Call me now.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The former Director General of the BBC says his resignation from the role is not just about the controversial editing of a speech by Donald Trump. Tim Davey announced he was stepping down on Sunday evening. The corporation is expected to apologise later on today over its use of the footage from 2021. Writing online, the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy's been thanking him for his work in public service broadcasting. On Sunday morning, she was talking to Lewis Goodall on LBC about whether she backed the BBC's management.
You say you feel you have these conversations a lot with BBC executives about various elements of news and so on. Do you have confidence in the Director General, Tim Davey?
I do have confidence in both Samir Shah and Tim Davey that they're treating this with the utmost seriousness.
Also going is the former chief executive of BBC News, Deborah Turnis. She said, "The buck stops with me," while announcing her resignation. Richard Tate is a professor of journalism at Cardiff University. He's been telling LBC the Trump edit was a major mistake.
People making the programme would have known that this was a very, very delicate area where you had to be very precise and, if you like, very straight in what you're doing. And I think that the edit they did was just not justifiable. And it was silly because they could have edited it in a way that made complete sense to the audience and wouldn't have caused the enormous grief that it has done.
And there'll be more on this with Jim Diamond here on LBC over the next hour. A man is due before magistrates later, charged with attempted murder after a woman was stabbed in the neck in Birmingham. The 21-year-old is also accused of two more assaults and possession of a blade. He was arrested after the attack in the city centre on Friday night. Syria's president is due to meet Donald Trump in Washington later on today. Ahmad al-Sharaa has been leading the country since Bashar al-Assad was deposed last December. He was once detained by US forces for joining al-Qaeda forces fighting the American American military in Iraq. And in sport, Manchester City are up to second place in the Premier League this morning after a 3-0 win against Liverpool. Aston Villa are now sixth after beating Bournemouth 4-0 on Sunday. And Nottingham Forest were the 3-1 winners against Leeds United. LBC weather, rain, which could be heavy at times, moving north from the southwest. Clear skies will develop behind that weather system and we'll see a low of around 8 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Day.